There is a correspondence that we have received. I'll start with the correspondence received from the department. Firstly, the one is dated the 3rd of September. And there's going to be a national conference from the 26th to the 28th of September. The conference intention is to launch a unified military veterans association. Members are invited to attend that one. Then there's also one for the exercise. I think Umuntu Okwazi Ukuthetha Isizulu will then assist me. Siboga, is it? There's the exercise Siboga. What does that mean? Siboga.
Every exercise is given a name.
What is? You are not responding to me. You are not a sort of speaking person. What does the book mean?
The word itself.
Yeah, the word itself. Is it a Sotho or a Sotho meaning? Oh, lovely. So there's going to be that exercise that started on the, what is this? In fact, we've been invited. Now, this one is going to take place on the 16th of October. Then members are also invited on that one. Then the one that is going to take place this week. There's going to be an exhibition that is taking place with the young man next to you. Can you talk to that one?
It will be at starting tomorrow. It will run for about a week. It will be at 8 o'clock. That will be for the Africa.
And Thursday, the 18th, is the day that the members be expected to join forces and be part thereof, to be flown from Cape Town to Pretoria. Is it?
Is that the one?
Oh, that's the Eastern Plateau. It's the Eastern Plateau one. This one is the October one that I'm talking about. Okay. The October one, members will be flown from Cape Town to Pretoria, and then back. So we'll have to block that particular day. When is it? It's the 18th October, the 16th of October. Hopefully it's not your birthday. Sisha? It's not. Then members we have written to the department. Firstly, you remember that you raised our concern regarding the, as we agreed in the last meeting, that we have to write to the Sunday Times regarding their obituary regarding the late Masilela. We indeed wrote that letter to Sunday Times, raising our disquiet regarding that. Similarly, we last week, you recall that there was that incident of that soldier that passed on in DRC. and followed by one who died in Sudan. We will then feel very strong that these things are happening and we as a country are saying nothing about that, either to the families or to the nation. We have written to the department requesting that they must assist us with the names of all those who passed on over the period of our duration in this parliament, starting from 2004 to date. And all those who sustained injuries, some incapacitated, so that we as parliament, we will communicate with them and their families accordingly, showing ubuntu. We also want to recognize those who are still serving outside, inside and outside the country, where we would want to have a debate in the House to give recognition and appreciation. To them and their families. I'm saying this because time and again, if you watch your big screens, in other countries, it does happen. It's only our country that does not do that. If it does, you find that it's somewhere in a corner or just a snippet that you find in your big screen to indicate that this has just happened and we say nothing about it. So it's a question of elevating and bringing our defense force into a pedestal befitting our soldiers. So that's then we've written to the department requesting this information so that we then apply to the speaker and have a debate at the same time, making a statement in the House. And that particular statement said to the various families and soldiers. So we have done that. Members, once again, we are here as the portfolio committee to conduct oversight and cause the department to account. Not in any negative way. I'm saying this in final because time and again we always seek information from the department. At times it does come very late to the portfolio committee. And some of these issues are already being picked up by the media and they run with it. I'm saying this because, you know, I went through one of the people that are so much concerned about what is happening within the defense and who writes much about it. Some of their articles, you know, when you begin to read them, they begin to pose a question, whether we're having a functional department or not. One article I read is one big heading that says, "Where is the defense update?" And they said a lot into it. Whereby they were saying today is the July 29th of 2008, exactly 2 months and 2 days after what was likely Defense Minister Michel Lukwele's last defense budget vote. Then they continue to begin to critique and criticize as to why the defense update is not right. But we as the portfolio committee, we've been requesting this. It must not be the media that begins to drive, it must be the portfolio committee that begins to drive and call for that information. You know, the issues that they also raise is South Africa defenseless against air attack, and they go at length with that particular one. And you find that every document, everything that they write, it's so detailed. It's so detailed as if they are getting the information right inside, which the committee does not have. It's not detailed, Chief. It really worries. They outline the indicators to what we have and what we do not have, and the weaknesses that are there. I'm saying this because it becomes more of a concern. If you can raise that, because letters are with your department, and we want responses accordingly. Now, coming back to the business before us, we welcome the department and welcome the members that. Before we allow the department to take us through the bill, the department must appreciate that we did once again went through the bill, and also the amendments that we agreed on the other day. But time and again, we tend to be very cautious that the product that we come up with must be a product that we're going to be proud of. We don't want to be seen or challenged to then say we did not apply our minds on it. You know, one embarrassing thing was what happened last year when the president had to reject a bill that has gone through both houses, and he had to come back because of the constitutional imperative, which was an oversight. But I tend to be very mischievous regarding that, because I keep on asking myself a question, Dr. Schoeman, to then say, but it's a product that came from the department to cabinet to parliament, and like that, because I always say, well, the president chairs, and how did it slip up? So we are all equally guilty, because it can also be picked up by the Constitutional Court. Because at the end of the day, if somebody challenges it, even after the president, you remember, Madiba, if it goes through the president and it lands with the Constitutional Court, somebody comes and challenges it, it then says, all of us, we did not look into the Constitution. I'm then saying, before we start then, there are some issues that we looked into, which we would also want the department to reflect on, so that we can agree on some of those. And most probably, the department will also be coming with some few answers, or answers that will be informing us to how to address some of those specific issues that the committee members would want to bring up. I'm not sure, Mr. Shah. I saw your hand.
Chair, you will be giving us an opportunity later or after the presentation, or do you want us to raise these issues that we thought about before he begins?
Preferably, let's deal with those issues, because immediately go through clause by clause. It would then, so we can't come after and bring those issues up. Let's start by bringing those issues up so that we can begin to incorporate them.
Thank you, Chair.
Into it, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Should I then?
No, I will start with Dr. Conway has already indicated that we'd want to bring some of the crucial issues. Then I will allow you, Dr. Shah, Mr. Shah. Dr. Conway.
Chair, can I address the department on a number of issues? If you can just make a list of these issues. Some of them may be smaller definitional issues or referring to the explanatory memorandum. Some of the others may be major issues. So if you allow me, just go through the issues that I've picked up. In the definitions, we have a competent authority definition. But in the explanatory memorandum, it's a major change we made to competent authorities. We agreed on that, but it's not referred to specifically in the explanatory memorandum. First question is whether you would consider to, it's just for the plain simple language, to say, make a reference to in the explanatory memorandum about the competent authority, whether you can do that or not. That's the first question. Number two is if you go to clause 20. Clause 20 talks about the exemptions. Now, again, a technical question. You talk about emergency or special operations in line 5. My question to the department is whether we need a definition of these two terms, a definition of emergency operations, and whether we need a definition of special operations. If you can just address that one. Then further, in line 9 of clause 20, we refer to the export and import of control items. My question to the department is, why do we have to make exemptions here for the SANDF and SAPS to export control items? We understand the word import to give permission. Why do we have to give exemptions on exports? That's my next question to the department. The next one is on administrative fines. That is clause number 19. I'm a bit concerned, Comrade Chair, about this one, and after I've thought about it and consulted a little bit wider, this clause, in a sense, give a very restart on this one. It gives the effect that the committee can have the effect of a court judgment in this clause. And my question is, it makes the decision of the NCACC, in other words, equivalent to the judgment of a court. That my question is this in line with the Constitution, where we say the highest authority to make a judgment on legal issues is a court? And what legal effect does this have? And then on that same page, subclause 10, I'm talking to administrative fines, page 12 of the amendment bill, line 50. No prosecution may be instituted against a person if a person concerned has paid an administrative fine. Now, this cannot surely bind a prosecution authority if that person has paid already an administrative fine. My question is, again, a constitutionality of this subclause 10. In other words, firstly, the NCACC is the equivalent to a judgment of a court in a civil matter, and secondly, whether you can, no prosecution may be instituted when such person has already paid an administrative fine. And my very last question, thank you for your indulgence, is on when we talk about the exemptions and limitations, I'm talking the cross-reference. Let me just find where it's the cross-reference. Somebody must help me. In the explanatory memorandum, page 18, we talk about cross-reference to be fulfilled with the exemptions and limitations provided by this Act. And there you list a lot of different acts. The question is, how is this to be done? This cross-reference in the explanatory memorandum. It's not in the Act, but it's in the memorandum. Where and how is this going to be done? Thank you, Chair.
Sir, thank you, Dr. Graf.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Sorry. I just want to, but before I draw your attention to clause 14, dealing with end user certificate, section 17 of the Act, before I do that, I just want to remind us, I'm not sure whether Mr. Gladla had responded. On the 26th of August, in that meeting, there was an issue which Mr. Gladla was supposed to take up with the NCC and report back to us. He said he was going to meet with them on the 28th, that Thursday. I think it was to do with the deletion of 7-2, no member of NCC will sit on those subcommittees. The question we asked was why? Because the question was, in the past it was so, and why is it not in violation of the Act? I don't know whether it was about that matter that he was supposed to come back to us. I would like him to inform the House about that. Chair, I remember asking this question, and I think Mr. Gladla did give us an answer as well on the issue of the exemption clause. In terms of end user certificate, the committee may on such terms and condition as may be prescribed exempt an exporter from compliance with subsection 1 on a case-to-case basis. There are certain set criteria, etc. I'm still a bit uncomfortable with the fact that I can understand the response of Mr. Dalla. He said that these were very small components that form part of something else. And I think I had raised my concern at that time, that though something can be a component or a subcomponent of something bigger, that particular item can be something very, very vital for that bigger component. And I think I gave an example of a trigger. A trigger is a very little component used in the explosion of to get fission grain. You understand what I'm saying? So I think I would be happy. I would be actually happy if they would actually give some indication in the Act itself as to a little bit about what those, maybe not details, but terms and conditions. When you say, are these terms and conditions, regulations actually stipulated in terms of the criteria? Is it there? Does it say? We don't know what it says. Is this not a loophole which can be abused by somebody? You know, I'm not saying that people are dishonest, but you know, if you don't tighten things up, things can happen, you know. So I would like Mr. Dalla to tell us, is he comfortable with this exemption that they have the rules and regulation and set criteria, which is, you know, rigorous, etc.? Because it doesn't clarify it here. It's not clarified, you know. What are those terms and conditions? I do understand when he says this. It's a little part, you know, you can't follow it up and get an end user certificate, you know, for every little part. But I would like to see something more concrete in the Act in this regard. I don't know. I hope I'm not being ridiculous. Thank you.
I know what Mr. Gladla is going to say, Mr. Shah. You simply say, are you comfortable with this? Because he wants us to make proposals when necessary. But it's worth it that we have to engage. If you have a key proposal, then one would appreciate so that we can then begin to engage on that particular proposal that you're coming up with. So that's then I'm then saying, at times we don't have to push them into a corner, because it's not for him to be comfortable with it, it's us.
Well, what I would like, Chair, with your permission, is to actually see what those terms and conditions are in the Act itself. That's what I would like to see. Under what conditions may an item be exempted? That's what I would like to see.
I think that's all well before we start to and proceed with what is before us. Those crucial issues, Mrs. Lassa and the team. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's our privilege again to appear before this committee and try to deal with the matters that have been raised by the committee in respect of the bill. But Chairperson, before I just try to engage these matters, I would firstly say that I think some of the questions that have been asked and would require the delegation to have some time to reflect on them, and reflect on them very, 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 very carefully, because we would not want just to make statements which may not necessarily be 100% accurate, particularly on matters that Dr. Korinoff had asked. And I think we would request some time to reflect on those. But obviously, we'll give our preliminary response to those. Given the fact that at the time when we drafted the bill, there were particular intentions that we wanted to get across. And as such, therefore, we'll try to give it some responses. But however, that should be subject to further discussion amongst ourselves, and therefore we'll come back and give you a firm position on them. In the last meeting that we had, Chairperson, we had to, in my understanding, there were quite a number of matters that we addressed, and we came to a position where there was a general consensus on quite a number of them. And as such, therefore, we were requested to update the A list so that it reflects the consensus by the committee and the department. And as such, therefore, at the same time, we had to try, therefore, to superimpose those consensus points onto the bill, so that as we do line-by-line reading, we do so within the context of the bill, so that we don't have to look this side, left and right, as we try to get through. We have tried to do that as a department, and we submitted to the Secretariat of the Committee two documents that try to address exactly those particular points. However, Chairperson, as I'm here now, before we get down to that work, and obviously the issues raised now may or may not have some bearing on how we read the bill when we come to line-by-line reading. There is quite a number of questions that have been asked, but I think I would, from time to time, my colleagues here will come in and respond to some of them, and I will therefore tackle them as a team, as it were. Dr. Korinoff asked about six questions. And many of them are quite loaded, and they require some application of the mind. The first one that he asked is, how do we deal with the issue of under definition, the issue of competent authority? Who is competent authority? Is the competent authority that we're talking about now a similar one that was there before the amendment was actually started? That is the question. And we are saying, well, it's not necessarily the same. We admit to that there has been some changes that we have tried to implement in respect of the definition of the word competent authority. But as we do so, I think that amendment was informed by the thinking that we needed to define the roles of the committee versus that of the minister. As you would recall, that at some point I had to deal at length with the issue of saying when in the bill do you use the word competent, do you use the word minister, and when do you use the word committee? And I think if you look at what that section seeks to do in our reading, is that it actually takes out the minister and the chair of the NCECC, and it therefore says a competent authority means the committee or any subcommittee to which, and therefore it actually continues. Maybe the question that is being asked, therefore, is to say, why are we taking out the minister as well as the chair of the NCECC?
Sorry, can I intervene? This is not the question. The question is, we've accepted the competent authority definition.
Yes.
We agreed in the committee. I'm asking whether the definition, just for easy English reading, should not be included in the explanatory memorandum. To say that if a competent authority means a committee or subcommittee, that's all. We're not changing the definition. The definition we agree to. I just want a cross-reference in the explanatory memorandum for the person who doesn't have the time to read through the bill, to go through the explanatory memorandum and the definitions and say a competent authority in this means a committee or subcommittee. That's all. No definition.
Okay. No, I think I understood it differently. But I'm just saying, I think, therefore, if that is the concern, I think what we can therefore say is to say, as a department, you can therefore look at the explanatory memorandum, try to update that to reflect the meaning of competent authority as defined. defined in the bill, and I think we can do that. And maybe we admit, therefore, that in the memorandum that there was no specific reference to that. And I think we can therefore make that specific reference so that there is indeed some consistency between the bill as well as the memorandum. I think we can do that, Chairperson.
We agree on that.
I'll proceed to the next item, which relates to clause 20 of the bill. With regard to the issue of exemption, and those exemptions, as they were proposed, they related to exemptions to the SANDF as well as the SAPS. And the question there is therefore, if you are exempting, you're providing such an exemption for special operations, what is a special operation? And as such, if you say special operation, why do we therefore deal with special operation in respect of import and export? And I think I understand the question to be saying that.
Just to make it clear, straightforward, whether we need a definition of emergency operation or special operation. I just need you to explain it's no need for that, or yes, we need to define it in the definition sections. And the second part of that question is, if you look at line 10, it relates to the export and import of control items. Now, the import of control items, of course, normally you will have the committee to deal with it. Just explain to us why it's also necessary to do control items of the SANDF and SAPS to export to a foreign country. It's straightforward whether the word export also must be here. We just need the clarification of why we use export and imports and whether we need a definition for emergency or special operations. We're open to your explanation.
I think, Chairperson, maybe I can see the point that says if you're providing an exemption for a particular event or for a particular activity, which is special operation, you need therefore to make that very clear so that it doesn't lend itself to various interpretations. And I think therefore, I think at the time when you put the word special operations, we had therefore assumed that it's just a common, I think in the military and defense department, the word operation is a commonly used term. And I think we have therefore assumed that it was a wrong assumption we had made up front, that we need therefore for a person who's not in the defense sector may not understand operation in the same way that we do. And as such, therefore, there could be a need to actually define that, to say special operation would relate to activities of the following kind, so that this discretion is not exercised in a vacuum. It's exercised within limitations, to say a special operation will therefore relate to this and that. These are the parameters. I think, Chairperson, we can attempt to define that. But I think in our case, when we're saying special operations and in respect of export and import, which is another subset of the question, lastly, the issue of special operations that we're trying to deal with here is largely in the instance of export than import. More so because we were saying some other time you'll find that the high level, well, the president, let's just say the president, at some point he had to go to certain areas of different parts of the world where he needed to be protected to a particular level. And as such, therefore, he calls upon special forces of defense department and special forces of police or special task force of the police to actually be part of that protection system. And as such, we are saying as they deploy, export there, they take items which are controlled, military rifles and all of that. And we are saying those constitute special operations because he goes there for a particular business, he needs to come back. But then if you were to subject the authorization of that export to a lengthy process, you may therefore compromise the entire business of going there by the president. And as such, if many people start to get involved, it may even undermine the level of security that he can be exposed to. So in our case, we're saying, largely in the case of exports, that is where this special authorization will come in, so that he can be able to deploy and be able to be protected, but at the same time, give the chairperson plus one minister of the NC opportunity to give that authority. But when it comes to import, largely imports, when they are coming in, there is no crisis per se, because they are bringing the items back, and there's no pressure to bring them back. There's normally a pressure to take them out when somebody has got to be protected. I think in our instance, this issue is much more applicable in export than it is for imports. But I think on the issue of special operations, I think we can just give it a best shot in terms of defining what a special operation is, so that it doesn't lend itself to confusion.
Yeah, I think we agree on that one. I saw your hand there, Mr. Shaw. On the same issue.
Yes, Chair. I know I'm the one that asked all these silly questions. I just wanted to come back to the exemption to SNDF and the issue of export and import. Yeah, I understand Mr. Dadla's explanation. When he says export exemption from export, and when you talk about import, are you saying suppose you exempted a particular item from going, so the very same item is exempted from coming back, or are you saying a new item then is exempted from being imported by the SANDF? When you say that the chairperson and member of the committee may, in case of an emergency or special operations, at the request of a national commissioner or the SANDF, chief of the SANDF, may exempt from the provision of this act for export and import. Are we saying that the item that is being exempted is the item which they are taking out, and it is the same item that is exempted from coming back? Because as I see it now, when you say relating to export and import, it could be export of what they're taking with them. Import, they can bring something else back. What did stop them from, in terms of the fact, from bringing something totally different from what they took? Okay, that one, I know this sounds silly, but I'm asking the question. Second thing.
Why don't you align? Is it the same?
Same section, special operations. In case of an emergency or special operations, you did explain what emergency, protection, all of those things. What if, I give you the scenario, what if without the authority of Parliament, okay, I'll give you a scenario so that you can understand the problem. The chief of the SANDF decides that they want to undermine Lesotho. Suppose. And this is not with parliamentary approval, it's a special op. We don't know, the committee knows, nobody knows. Now, it sounds silly, but he wants to assist with material forces in Lesotho, some of whom belong to our own special forces who have been there for that specific purpose, with other elements of Lesotho. Now the question is, in terms of this act, what is there to stop them from providing weapons, etc., for forces that are bent on undermining another in a state? And they can, this is special ops. This is special ops. Nobody needs to know about it. It's exempted. Those weapons have gone and things are happening. So it's a scenario I'm presenting to you. Now, I know it sounds silly, but listen. Special ops. It's a special ops undermining a neighbor. Finish. How do we monitor that?
Please, Mr. Lash. I think to deal with the scenario first, so it's still fresh in the mind. Maybe it comes back to the whole point of actually saying, as we define the word special operations, we'll therefore say special operations will include the following kind, and will therefore include that there should be a legitimate exercise, I think a lawful exercise, so that if somebody therefore tries to undermine other governments, that will not fall within the ambit of the word legitimate stroke lawful. So I think therefore the more the reason why we should define the word special operation to exclude instances like those that Mr. Shah is raising. And I think therefore the definition can try to provide some relief with respect to that. But the other point, Chairperson, is I think there is this assumption maybe that we have that when people in authority are actually saying, are signing certain documentation and saying, if the Minister of Defense comes forward, let me just make this scenario,
most often than not, when the SANDF is deploying, even if it's not an emergency, what we insist upon is documentation that has been signed by people in authority to indicate that the deployment is something that is lawful. The presidential minute, the cabinet presidential minute, as it's called, and all other documents. And therefore, we assume that those documents would not just come if those issues are not above board. And we work on the basis that those documents are legitimate, and they are not intended to be undermining any authority in the country or elsewhere. So I think obviously then, by the definition, defining the word special operation in a manner that I've just proposed, I think we'll try to provide some relief to some of the concerns that Mr. Shah is raising. But his first question was, therefore, if we're talking about exports and imports or under special emergencies for SANDF and SAPS, what guarantee do we have that what goes out is indeed what comes back? I think the arrangement that we're putting here is that now this equipment can be sent out, but all that we're saying is that the documentation that actually details what those equipments are would still be provided, but it may not be, it may be after they have sent them or in the process of sending them out. But then when they are bringing the items back, we'll have to check whether what they exported in terms of the document is indeed what they are bringing back into the country. There should be reconciliation between the two. And if there are discrepancies, there should be reason why that is the case. If ammunition has been used, they must therefore say, look, we've used ammunition, there was a situation that we had to deal with, and this quantity of ammunition has been used. That's why we are returning ammunition minus 20 or 40. And I think there will be a rigorous process to try to ensure that there is indeed a reconciliation between exports and imports. But you must, Chair, I think in the case of import, when they are bringing it back, most often than not, there is no pressure. I'm just saying, now you're going back home. The operation is over. There is no pressure. You can find that we may therefore go through the normal process. But at the time of export, because there's a situation to be dealt with, it becomes. But I think the documentation will always be there to ensure that there is indeed a proper reconciliation between the two.
No, thanks, Chairperson. Thanks, honorable members. My apology for coming late. The storm weather couldn't allow us to land properly.
But we started.
Yes.
We started. Yeah. Why you apologize?
Oh, I didn't notice that. No, I'm just saying perhaps this definition should also take note of the normal special ops of the defense so that it doesn't confuse us with the normal operations of the defense force. So that if there can be a distinction. Thanks.
Do you understand that? Yes, I do, Chair. I think we had that in mind, because I think what we're dealing with here is special operations. But for operations where SANDF deploys in DRC or Burundi or Sudan, those are not emergencies. I mean, a decision to deploy, I think it takes about 2 to 3 months to complete and preparation and all of that. And we are saying to the SANDF or SAPS, as they go through those processes, they must also factor into the equation the issue of arms control, because there is no emergency there. It takes about 2 to 3 months to deploy, prepare troops and all of that. But we are dealing here with this specialized kind of situation where suddenly somebody has got to go somewhere and he needs protection for 2 days, 3 days. And some other time, before you know, you only hear that he's already there. You don't know when he left. So we're saying this is just specifically for that. But we'll ensure that we distinguish that from normal run-of-the-mill operations. I think, Chair, the next question would be dealt with by my colleague, Ms. Njigela, on admin fines and the subsequent question to that.
Yeah, I missed my one question on clause, what was it, clause 17, on the exemption issue, remember? Under certain terms and conditions, how do you intend to close that loophole a little bit? How do you intend to do that? Do you think it's possible to actually tighten that one up by putting in some terms and conditions? You did respond to it, but I'm saying, what's your thought? Do you think it's unreasonable? or do you think it can be done?
I think, Chairperson, what I was doing, we were trying to deal first with the first batch of questions that Dr. Korenoff had asked. And I think these were intending to come back to the two questions that he had raised with respect to the scrutiny committee and my feedback to NCCC and all of that. And I was going to deal with EUC when it comes to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll just deal with the question relating to admin files that was asked by Dr. Korenoff. And Chair, I must say right from the beginning, this is the question we spend some time on exactly this issue, as to how exactly can we balance these two rights or these two obligations. And what we sought firstly to do was really to look at what are the offences that are created by the Act and figure a way of differentiating those from just your admin violations of the Act. Like a person not returning, I think the example Mr. Lala made, a person not returning a weapon within a particular time frame, maybe by a day or so. So we're trying to distinguish those offences that are criminal in nature, where a person trades without a permit, and from the administrative violation. And then if we agree that there should be that kind of distinction, then we moved on to say, do you really want to drag this kind of admin violation through the whole court process, or you can simply allow people to be dealt with administratively by the NCACC itself? And Chair, of course, the relevant question that has already been asked, is it proper for the NCACC to be seen to be usurping powers that we ordinarily vest in the court? But the manner that we have tried to do this thing is not by excluding the jurisdiction of the court. In as much as we empower the NCACC to impose the kind of fines we envisage here, but at the same time we respect the right of individuals that are accused of such violation to make an election as to whether they want to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the NCACC in terms of fine, or they want to go the court processes. So it's really, there is an election between, and that's how we're trying to strike that balance between the jurisdiction of the court and the jurisdiction of the NCA. So there is a right of election, because I may say I prefer to be dragged before the court, even if it takes me 10 years, and therefore I don't want to subject myself. But there is no unilateral taking or removal of rights of people to be subject or of access to court in terms of this. But we just say individuals who are willing to plead guilty and accept fines in terms of the admin fine, they are able to do that in terms of this provision without taking away the constitutional right or obligation of the courts to deal with such violation. So that's how we're really trying to create that balance. But I think the question that Dr. Korenoff was really asking was whether this, now, because we don't only say we impose that, but we're going on to say, if there has been such an imposition of a fine, that fine, it will prevent later prosecution. Then I think, again, the question that we need to debate here is whether it will be fair to subject a person to a fine and yet expose him to a prosecution later. So our view was that when there is such a fine, that should automatically preclude prosecution on the same issue. So it does not take away, it could be that there was some kind of other violation, other than the violation itself for which a fine was imposed. So we will impose the fine, but we think it's only fair that once that fine has been imposed, there should be no prosecution based on exactly the same facts as for the one that for which the fine was imposed. So there is a debate that we perhaps need to have, but I think one needs to take note that this is not the first kind of a legislation that imposes this kind of administrative fines. If you look, for instance, at the Competition Commission Act, it has a similar provision, and that kind of balance is built into the system itself. So, but perhaps I think it's an issue that the committee has to apply its mind. But they, we're not taking away the rights of the court to prosecute people. But where a fine has been imposed on the same facts, we think it will be unfair for the court to then proceed and punish that person for the second time for that same offense. So that's the balance we're trying to create, and I think we've covered it quite nicely, Chair. But I think the committee may want to compare the provisions that we have to other legislation like the Competition Commission, which has similar kind of provisions. Thank you, Chair.
I think that you're saying you're quite comfortable with that. And I allow Dr. Korenoff, then I'll allow your colleague to also respond to it. Dr. Korenoff.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure, the simple question is simple. When we pass this bill, what you're saying to us, there's no possibility that this bill may be referred back to say on these two issues, there will be a constitutional challenge. A, on to make the NCACC the equivalent to a judgment of a court in a civil matter, and B, that the sub 10, if instituted against a person, then concerned as patent administrative fine, there will be no prosecution. I just want to make sure constitutionally this bill is sound. We will not get a referral back. That's the bottom line question that the committee has to get the insurance from you as a legal expert. There will not be a constitutional challenge, as far as you know, against this bill on this clause 19.
Perhaps I'm too close to the fire. I will allow the state law advisor to deal with the issue of constitutionality because I may not be entirely objective.
Thank you, Chair. Just in addition to what Mr. Njinkela said, when the administrative fine is imposed, you know, the committee must have regard to the rules of fair administrative action. So the whole process will be a fair process. And in addition to that, person will be subjected to a administrative fine will have an option to either go to the court. So the right to access to the courts is still very much intact in terms of the provisions of the bill as is before the committee. I just wanted to add to what Mr. Njikela said with regard to that. But maybe if the committee would allow us, maybe just as Mr. Dlada said, maybe just to reflect on it again in total and then come back to you on that issue. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Echelis, thanks. But let me allow Dr. Schoeman. I forgot.
Whatever action that the committee is going to take, will it be equivalent to what the court would say or do, or the processes? They will apply the same processes. Once a person is given an option to subscribe to the fine or go to court, I was just going to check if there will be a balance in the process.
Ms. Angela, whilst appreciating that, we'd be going back to reflect on this. You also spoke about the Competition Act. I'm talking about us now, not them, and that particular act. What are we saying? If you get what I'm saying. Because we're here to shape our laws. If they were fortunate enough not to be picked up by the Constitutional Court, if I may, because we cannot find ourselves referring to theirs. If ours is also going to correct them, let it be so. That's one thing that I think Dr. Corrin have started from that particular point to then say, let us come up and firm up, because we are also want to be constitutionally correct. So that whatever has been a slip-up, or I wouldn't say deliberately so, but if we were to correct other acts, let us do it. That is why I would allow that you as we have agreed, that reflect on that once again, because we are not comfortable, Dr. Schoeman, Dr. Koranov also. We were not comfortable. If we can look into it very finely, rather than to keep on then saying no, there are other acts that we can also talk to because they've been, you know, they've been applied. So let's look into that. Let's look into that. Let me once again take Dr. Schoeman.
Thank you. Chair, if I can just maybe add, I think the concern is that with an administrative fine, it leaves a lot of leeway for the committee to what extent that fine must be, because it can be up to 10% of the turnover of that company, which can amount to a very large sum. But it can also, on the other hand, just be a slap on the wrist. So, and the committee, if it hasn't got very firm guiding principles saying administrative fine in case of this will be that, although such a person
will have access to appeal to the court and get a court judgment. You see, it can go both ways. It can be very severe, or it can just be a slap on the wrist. And I think this is a concern that we also have. Is the committee really equipped to weigh all the pros and cons and give a judgment similar to what a court would have given?
I think, Chairperson, my colleagues have just tried to delve into that. But I think our position is that we would want to have a look at that very carefully. And obviously, we would make reference to what they, again, look at what the Competition Commission has in all of it. But obviously, not taking that as the Bible, it's not. Because our circumstances are not similar to the circumstances that got to make determinations about. But what is key to us is that the administrative fine will be a result of an administrative process. And it's not obviously a judicial process. And I think they will be different. It will not operate like a court, because the court has got a particular mechanism it follows. But what is important to us, both in the court as well as in this admin process, is that there should be an application of the laws of administrative justice. A person must be given an opportunity to present his case. He must be heard, and therefore he must be quizzed on the representation that he'll be making. And he must have a representation if he wants to do so. And at the end of it, therefore, you'll come to a conclusion. That is not arbitrary, but that it takes into account all the relevant facts as presented. And obviously what it therefore means to us is, if this provision gets through here, but I think in the regulations, I think the details have got to be thoroughly threshed out in terms of all this. How do you give effect to the laws of administrative justice? How do you talk about representation? How do you talk about the principle of all the acts from partem and all of that? So I think there will be details, but the challenge is going to be, and I think we need to be upfront about it, is that there would therefore be a requirement for an upscaling of capacity of the NCCC to look into all these matters, because it is not just a thing that you dispense with in a matter of 1 hour. You need to have a dedicated capacity to be able to engage with that. But, Chairperson, we're going to have a look at that very carefully and provide the necessary feedback to the committee.
Thank you very much. Church, I will deal with the issue of cross-referencing. I think it was, again, Dr. Koronov. In page 18 of the memo, we refer to a number of acts there. Which have a direct impact on the issue of control of weapons. Now, Chair, what we sought to achieve here was really to make sure that these various acts, they speak to each other, that there is no overlap of jurisdiction here. Now, I think the issue of the Mercenary Act is quite key, that although we give powers to the NCACC in that act, those powers were not reflected in the enabling act of the NCACC. And then, naturally, Chair, we wanted to create that cross-reference. But there are various other acts that deal with explosives, with other kinds of weapons like the nuclear and all those. But what we're trying to do in respect of those, if you look at the clause, Chair, that deals with the issue of possession, there are a number of references to various acts there, which acts are reflected in the memo. So we're just trying to create that cross-referencing as to how, within the context of the NCACC, the interaction between those acts and the NCACC Act will be managed. So I think there is specific reference in the body of the bill itself to all those acts. If I understood Dr. Gorenov, he was saying there is no reference in the bill to those acts. There is specific reference in the bill under possession to those other acts other than the Prohibition of Mercenary Act. So we just wanted to make sure that they speak to each other and there is no overlap with regard to jurisdiction, that matters that are controlled under the Explosive Act, we should create space for those to be administered of, in as far as they relate to the NCACC. So that's just what the boundary we're trying to manage there, Chair. Thank you very much.
No, I agree with you. The question is that on page 18, we mention a number of acts that affect the work of the committee. but nowhere in the bill does it talk to the work of the committee being affected by these acts. I just want to make sure whether it's, again, the memorandum talks about something, but it's not in the act. So what I'm trying to say is we, in the memorandum, we cross-reference to other legislation that affects the work of the committee. But within the bill, there is no relevant provision to spell that out. So it's not a major issue. It's just maybe the drafting or the quality of the style. So it's not a major issue. I'm just raising the issue. It's not necessarily talking to one another. Do I make myself clear?
That's the thing of the bill, not addressed. Sorry. That's the thing on page 7 of the bill, not address the concern.
Page 7.
Clause 10, starting from line 41 up to the next page, which is page 8, all the acts you see, we specifically refer to them and how they interact with the NCAC in those two pages.
It may, but again, here we refer to Mine Health and Safety Act 1996, for instance, but it's not an explanatory memorandum. So maybe the ideal would be to have all the measures consolidated into a single act. That would have been the ideal. But no, it's not a major issue. I'm just saying it's a drafting style issue, that we refer to certain acts in page 18. Some of them are repeated on page 7 and 8, but not all of them. Some 8 and 9, we have certain acts not mentioned in the memorandum. So for the ordinary layperson reading the explanatory memorandum, it's a bit difficult to determine which acts or legislation affects the work of the committee. That's all I'm saying. It should be just be consistent.
That is a heavy one that you just mentioned, consolidated into a single act. consolidated Mr. Njikela into a single act. How do you take that one, Mr. Tlatla?
I think, Chairperson, we understand where the coroner of is coming from. Maybe, as I said earlier, on other questions that have been asked, I think ours is just to revise again that section of the memorandum so that it speaks to these issues in the manner that we may take that section on page 18 of the memo and just try to expand on it in a manner that therefore clears all the misunderstanding around it. But the intention of actually cross-referencing to us was simple. It was that, you see, conventional arms, by their very nature, have got implications for quite a number of things. You find that the police have got competence to deal with explosives. They've got an explosive section that deals with that. But some of the explosives, you find that they can be controlled under the SAPS legislation, Explosives Act, and some of them can therefore be regulated under the NCEC Act. And in Section 13, what we are doing in respect of many items is to say, when those have got to be dealt with under those acts, we are saying the NCCC will not have jurisdiction over those because the there is already acts of parliament that are dealing with them. But we'll be dealing with those that are specific to the NCECC. But I think what we're going to do is actually in the memo, just try to make clear that on each one of them, well, what is it that we intend saying, so that it, in the reading, it becomes reader-friendly.
Listen, Jigela, are you comfortable with the standing arrangement, if I may?
I am pretty comfortable, but I think the point Mr. Lala has already made, I get a feeling that the concern is the memo does not reflect, it's abridged, in the sense that it does not reflect all the amendments that have actually been effected in the bill itself. So I understand the concern to be saying, try and reflect as much in the memo as you have included in the bill itself. So I think we just need to manage that, because we try to, in a very summarized manner, to reflect the major changes that we're effecting in the bill. But indeed, we're not reflecting each and every amendment in the memo. So I think that's where the confusion comes from. And I understand you're going to reflect all the major, in fact, all the amendments in your memo that you're effecting in the Act, so that you don't appear to be just, you know, selectively highlighting what you want us to take note of. Reflect all those. So I think we can manage that, Chair. I'm pretty comfortable.
Yabona kumahle umama uMahlala nomama Njeri bazathi awu ngane yami yabona ke lokho mina sengizavele ngifunde lapha neqhineni nje. No, I hear you quite clearly, she said, Dr. Skuman. I'll come to you, Mr. Shah.
I think the memo must just be in plain English for an ordinary layperson to read this and understand what this bill is. Then he can go to the bill and read the legal language. It just may be, and maybe just before we finalize the bill or the department, just go through the, or we can do it as well, the bill, amendment bill, and the explanatory memorandum, that there's no omissions or statements that doesn't talk to one another. It's just a styling, drafting, making a good piece of legislation. It's not a major issue, but it's an important issue. It must be, we said we must write laws in plain English that is understandable to the ordinary citizen that wants to read a piece of legislation.
Thank you, Chair. Under the same section 13, G1, in the case of maintenance, repair, or upgrade of control items, I think these are some of the conditions actually that we had discussed, which you have now incorporated. G1, possession is permitted if such possession is only for the purpose of maintenance, repair, or upgrade of control items belonging to a duly registered person as contemplated in section 13. Why is it person? Isn't it authorized entity, registered entity? Because if somebody has a company and he's working in that company as a specialist, but is he registered, or is the company he works for registered? So can you just explain belonging to a duly registered person? Do you issue a permit to the person who works in a particular company, or is the permit issued to the company to actually carry out the upgrade and repair? I don't know, I'm understanding it correctly, am I?
I think, Chairperson, in the last deliberation that we had, we tried to say, I think we're using the word a person here as defined in the under definition, and it refers to both natural person as well as juristic person, meaning a corporate person. So in this business, you find that a person, somebody can, Dinel would be registered as Dinel, which is a juristic person, is still a person. But then there could be somebody who is a one-man show, who is just a service provider of some kind, and he operates under his name, Dumisani Lala, and therefore that person is a natural person. But I think in our view, Chair, we think the word person here is a better word to use than entity, because if you say entity, you are therefore excluding natural persons. We are only talking about companies, but we want to cover both companies as well as individuals.
Yes, later, but, you may proceed.
I think, Chair, I'll now proceed to the question that Mr. Shah had asked. I think we've come to that stage. He asked a question. about at some point I had made an undertaking that I was going to consult with the NCACC and seek some new instructions. And that was in relation to, in my understanding, it was in relation to the proposal around scrutiny committee. And I had come back in the last meeting that we had and reflected that we had consulted the NCACC and we had therefore given clear instructions that we have to withdraw the word scrutiny committee proposal in its entirety. I think those were instructions. And secondly, on the issue of 7.2, remember we had said if we lose scrutiny committee, we would want therefore to amend Section 7.2 of the Principal Act and remove the requirement to have a member of the NCACC sit in subcommittees. And we therefore said, the committee was very clear on that. They said you cannot amend a section that has never been tested, meaning you would leave that section as is. And I think we had assumed that position. So I think we are not amending Section 7 on subcommittees. They would remain with the requirement to have a minister serving in the NCACC to serve in subcommittees. That is how it stands. And reference to scrutiny committee was in total taken out. On the second issue that Mr. Shah had raised is about the exemptions on the EUC and user certificates. And the question was, therefore, what would be those terms and conditions? How would they look like? Because it would be best to have those terms and conditions as clear as mud, as they say. I think, in my last intervention on the matter, I had tried to present a thesis why we had come with the proposal around the exemptions to EUCs. But we have said the EUC exemption would not just be given lightly. It will have to be, firstly, be proposed or be requested by an applicant. And once the applicant has said, I request to be provided exemption, there should therefore be a process that is followed to look into that particular request and therefore look at that, interrogate that, and therefore come to a conclusion. But in the interrogation process, what should therefore come up is to say, what is the nature of the items that he wants to see exempted? I think the issue of items will come up to say, what is the nature and type of this equipment? Who is the intended end user? Is it a government entity? Is it a non-state actor? Is it those questions will come up. And thirdly, what is the intended use of it? Because an end user can get it, but he may therefore say, I'm going to use it for my own purposes and nothing else. Or he may say, no, I want to integrate that into a bigger system and re-export that to country Y. So I think basically key factors would be the nature of the item that you want to see exempted, the purpose, the use of the item that you want to see exempted, and who the end user of that item is going to be. And the other point would therefore be, what is the standing of the arms control system of the country where we are sending the item to? Because that would play a key role in determining whether you can give an exemption or not, because you would ideally require an importing country to have a arms control system that is above board, that is strong enough that you can rely on, because I think government to government, you have to look into that. But you may therefore, for instance, if you look at some of the countries, and they would have a strong arms control system, but others would have a weak arms control system, and you may therefore have to look into that and say, look, we are not convinced that that system would assist us in tracing that. And I even said in the last intervention, the whole reason of arms control system is not just arms control system, as it were, is to create a mechanism of accounting and responsibility in everything that is sold, so that 20 years down the line, we can still be able to trace an item and hold people to account where it was, where it went to, and all of it. So that is the whole purpose. And we are saying, by creating an exemption under the circumstances, you are not actually undermining those fundamental principles of accounting and responsibility. We're saying, if you have checked all those items I've referred to, type of an equipment, end user, purpose of use, and arms control system, you can still 15 years down the line go to a country and say, we exported to you this component part. What did you do about it? And they will therefore say, we put it in this particular system, which we had sent to country X. And the EUC, under those circumstances, is this one. So you can still go there and find it. We're saying the principles that
that arms control seeks to achieve are not undermined under this. But all that it does, it creates a mechanism where you may not necessarily have this administrative hassle that we have to go through all the time. But we are not infringing on the fundamentals of arms control. But whether, therefore, the terms and conditions, obviously, when a decision is made that says these are the terms, and those should be very clear on the person that goes to. But I think what will make maybe Mr. Shah comfortable is the whole issue of saying, when you are now dealing with the details of exemptions, you've got to be spelling those things out to say, as the NCECC exercises its discretion over the exemption, it must take into account the following factors so that it doesn't become arbitrary. It must be according to a particular criteria, as it were, against which you can check and say that we are happy with this case, we are not happy with that other case. But I think that that detail will be provided, Chairperson. I doubt if the criteria can therefore be developed. Yeah, I would rather deal with it in regulation so it can be much more comprehensive. Thank you, Chair.
That's a commitment, Chief. In the regulations. You comfortable?
Yeah. Chair, then I would be a bit more comfortable because I don't see any loopholes here which can be abused by anyone. When you leave a loophole, got a problem.
That we left us in our report. That is recommendation to the House. We are done. I think now we have reached that point where we can now go through the bill clause by clause and making some marks where we made a commitment that you'd be going back and reflect some of the issues that we raised. We may start from that point now and move on. Over to you then.
Thank you, Chair. I think as we do so, I would want to draw the committee's attention to this document. It's the memo, but it's written in not the formal legal language. The reason is the bill that we had put through before it was put in the language that the state law advisor would put in their mechanisms. But what we have done is to take the points of agreement and put them in this document. And we are going, therefore, to look at that line by line. But what is important, therefore, is the style that we have adopted in doing so, because you recall that in the bill that we've been looking at for the past 2 weeks or so, there are proposals that have been made, but those proposals remain here, but some of them have got to be taken out, and we are indicating that those deletions as such. Chair, I will just therefore move to page 2 of the document, where there is the long title of the bill. It says bill over there, and in bold is written to amend the Arms Control Act and all of that. I think what we had done initially there, we had included on the line number 1, 2, 3, 4, on line number 5, we had included the word establish the scrutiny committee. Remember then the fact that we are saying scrutiny committee must not be recognized in this bill, and we have therefore taken out the scrutiny committee. So let's just say that is what we has been agreed upon, and we are eliminating that or deleting that particular section. And that's all that we are doing on that particular page, Chairperson. We'll therefore proceed to... I'm not sure, Chair, whether you want us to read line by line in that way or you want me just to refer to these points.
I would appreciate that you refer to the points because there will be now the day. I'm not sure whether tomorrow or next week, but we'll discuss that when we have gone and looked into the issues that have been raised. I think for now you can just highlight some of those so that when you come back now you are able now to go through line by line where we have to read it. Agreed?
Okay.
Shah? I can hear you shaking your head.
No, not yet.
Oh. You were not comfortable. I saw you frowning and... Okay then. I think you'll be comfortable with that approach. Members, are we comfortable with that, Dr. Schumann, Mrs. Sundberg? I think we'll be comfortable with that, that you just highlight some of those because we still have work that we still have to go and address. So that when we now come back, even if, I'm not sure, you'll be able to come back tomorrow. Or would you then want us to meet next week to go through it clause by clause? Because we have to apply to Parliament to extend that is the day that is the return date for the debate in the House, which is the 23rd.
I'm not sure, but that is it, because it has been set for the 23rd anyway.
Chairperson, our understanding was that we're going to be here tomorrow. Now I've not consulted on this. But I think my team would agree that after this we can look at the matters and be able to provide feedback on the matters tomorrow, if possible. And obviously I'm subject to to veto by and therefore we can commence with.
Very happy if we can make a breakthrough, because we've been dealing with this for some time now. Okay, then you may proceed.
Okay, I'll therefore come to page number 3, Chairperson. I think on page number 3, Chairperson, I think at the top there's a definition of armed conflict. It's just a definition. We've added the word armed conflict in the definition, but we are using therefore the definition as taken from the Mercenary Activities Act, and I think it is taken as is. There is no change to it. But on the following section, Chair, which is the paragraph B there, under brokering services, I must say, we had, from beginning to end, as you can see, from A, B, C, D, we had added the word controlled items. And the reason of that is that we have agreed that we are going to replace the word conventional arms with the word controlled items. And we have defined controlled items in the bill. That actually says controlled items will be inclusive of conventional arms, dual-use goods, as well as services. So where there's conventional arm, we are just taking that out and replacing it with the word controlled items. And that's what we're doing under the definition of brokering services. I think that's all that we're doing on that page, just two matters. Armed conflict definition, as well as the addition of controlled items where the word conventional arms appears. And I'll proceed to the next page, which is page number 4, Chairperson, if you allow me. Page number 4, Chairperson, on the D there, again, is a whole issue where we are just taking out, under the definition of the word contracting, we are just taking out the word conventional arms in bold, and the underlined word control items is the word that we are putting in. So let us say under D, we are just taking out conventional arms, replacing that with controlled items, in light with the definition of the word controlled items. And there's nothing that we're doing in paragraph E, and then we're coming to F. There's a particular insertion that we are making there. We are therefore saying we're trying to provide we are doing so. We are providing a definition of the word controlled items. And we're saying controlled items is defined in terms of Section 7.2 of 27.3, my apologies, 27.3. And if you look at that section, 27.3, it will therefore define controlled items as I have said. Firstly, it would say a conventional arms. Second, it would say dual-use goods. And thirdly, it would say services. And that is the definition of the word control item, so that there is no doubt about it. But it goes further than that. It says conventional arms, and it provides details of what those are. It doesn't just put a description. It provides details of what that is. And I think I've understood the committee and ourselves has agreed on that particular definition. Yes, Chairperson, I think all that I'm trying to do was just to get to the definition of controlled items. If you look at page 14 of the bill, there's a bill that has been just circulated, the one that has been made available to. If you look at page 14 of that, there would therefore be
paragraph 3 and 4, under 4, there is a 3 that is underlined, where it says the committee may, by notice in a gazette, publish a list of control items to which this act is applicable, including, and that A there talks about weapons, munitions, explosives, bombs, armaments, vessels, the whole of A, those are conventional arms. And if you look at B then, B largely relates to component parts, and but C is largely concerned with dual use goods, and then the D is services. So the word control items have got to be interpreted against this definition. It's comprehensive. But then I would therefore come back to page 4 of the document that is written in Word, a Word document that we have. I think under G, Chairperson, we were looking at the word convey there. But again, in there, we therefore replaced the word conventional arm in bold with the word control item in light of this definition that I've just referred to. So that's all that we're doing under G on page 4. And if you look at H on the same page, there is a definition of the word domestic transfer. And our initial proposal there was to say domestic transfer means the transfer of control items from one person to the other. But there was a whole discussion and the whole issue that AMSCO had raised and all of that, and we therefore agreed with the committee that we'll have to qualify the word domestic transfer to be only referring to ownership, where you are changing, transferring ownership. And that is why, therefore, the word ownership there is coming in under, is double underlined, to say that domestic transfer means the transfer of ownership of control items from one person to the other within the Republic. So that the title must change hands. And I think this is a result of our deliberations with the committee. And I'll proceed here to I. There's nothing that we're doing on I. On J, Chairperson, under export, again, we are taking out the word conventional arms and replacing that with control items. We are on the two sentences on page 4, we are doing that. And there has been the addition of the word there, outside it, by any person. I think it's a word that we had put there for purpose of ensuring that this reflects to about every person, meaning every entity, every individual is bound by this, inclusive of the SANDF and the SAPS, subject to if they have got an exemption, but otherwise they are bound by the export regulations. Chair, I'll proceed to K. Under K, Chairperson, as you can see there, it's the definition of the word import. Again, we are taking out the word conventional arms and conventional arms there and putting, replacing them with control items. That's all that we're doing under import, which is on page 5 of the document. And on page 5 again, under L, in the definition of manufacture, again, we are just replacing conventional arms with control items. And on M, which is the next paragraph, we are also doing the same. The definition of marketing is therefore conventional arms there is replaced with control items. There's actually three replacements that are taking place there. The next one, Chairperson, is a definition under N, which is the permit. We have therefore eliminated there, Chairperson, the whole wording in bold, in black. And we have said, therefore, we are defining permit by referring it to Section 14. Section 14 of the Act, we're saying permit should be interpreted as referred to in Section 14. And I will therefore draw your attention to Section 14, where the permit is being dealt with.
I see you have been replacing conventional arms control items, but I don't see where we're supposed to have inserted and possession of, isn't it? And in possession of as well, in all of these, but you haven't
I think Chairperson, I think Sasha is right, but I think what we've done, we have looked at the context. Because if we're talking about export, you can only export an item, a controlled item, but possession you can't export. I think export, well, possession is, it relates to South African situation, but as you can look there, you export an item, you manufacture an item, but you don't manufacture a possession. You don't export a... So I'm just saying, I think there will be instances where we are putting possession and controlled items together, but under these circumstances, it's only the issue of controlled items. Section 14, Chairperson, where we are saying we are defining a permit as contemplated in Section 14. Section 14 of the Act therefore says on page 12 of the original Act, under control and inspection, it says there under permits, any person who wishes to obtain a permit contemplated in Section 13 must apply to the committee in the prescribed manner. And it says that 2 of 14 says the committee may authorize the issue of permit subject to such conditions as it may decide upon or refuse to authorize the issue of a permit. And therefore there's a whole detail on the following page about what could be possible ramifications of a permit. So we're saying as we interpret a permit, you should do so by actually looking at what that section actually says. Because the reason is we never wanted to confine ourselves to a definition in respect of that, because there's quite a number of issues around it, and we wanted all those issues to be taken on board as one reflects on what a permit is. And here then I would, on page, on the same page, under O, or under NO, yes, it's O there, and we are actually inserting there a definition of the word prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in the Country of Armed Conflict Act. And just saying, that means the Act has actually promulgated. We're doing so, Chairperson, because there is, throughout the document, a heavy reference to this Act, and it's important that we recognize that as the Act which has got a bearing on this particular bill. And I'll proceed to page 6, Chairperson, if it's fine. And there, under Q, we are trying to substitute the word re-export. Or rather, well, under re-export, we're just taking out again the issue of conventional arms and replacing that with controlled items. And there's basically three items that are there, all in black, in bolded black. And under re-export, we are replacing them with controlled items. And the next section is R. In the R, Jefferson, we have taken out the entire reference to art. And the reason for that is that that section was only included for purposes of talking to the scrutiny committee. Now that the scrutiny committee has been taken out of this bill, we are therefore saying any reference to it should just be taken out, and therefore we are deleting that entire R section that deals with scrutiny committee. So by implication, we're saying the only committee that is recognized here is the NCCC and no any other committee. Any other thing that is there could be subcommittees established under the committee, which is the NCCC. Under F, Chairperson, on the same page 6, we are dealing there with the whole issue of citation of the Act. I think we had, at the time, when the Principal Act was drafted, the Defense Act was still the one version of 1957, but my colleagues have since updated that with Parliament, and now the correct citation is 2002. We're just being current, bringing it to in line with the current Act. And under U on page 6, under technology, again, we are replacing the word conventional arms with the word control items. And that's all that we're doing there. And the same with the under V, where we are defining trade-in. We are replacing the word conventional arms with the word control items, as indicated. And on page 7 of the document, we are again, under A there, we are taking not conventional arms, replacing that with control items. But under B, we are taking out the word the rendering of brokering services. But we are putting a new word, inserting a new word that says domestic transfer such as sale, takeover, letting, donation, transfer within the Republic. The reason for us to do that, I think it has been agreed to. We're saying brokering is already defined earlier in the definition. And here, what we are referring to is actually transfers. That will speak to those matters. Sale, takeover, letting, lending, donation, or transfer within. But then these are domestic transfers should be interpreted with the word with the earlier update of the definition transfer or domestic transfer. And here then I'll proceed to the amendment of Section 3 of the Act, which is still on page 7. And there is a 2A that we are coming to, and we are saying that implement government policy and applicable legislation. And I think that section actually creates the foundation for the NCCC, the duties that they are supposed to do, or the functions. But then we're saying here, it must implement government policy and applicable legislation, because policy is translated to legislation. The NCCC does both. It does the policy, and what we're doing here now is to translate the policy into legislation. So you must deal with both of them. But again, in the next sentence there, we are therefore taking out the word conventional arms. We are therefore putting the word controlled items. And we're saying they will deal with various matters, possession of controlled items, prohibition of Mercer Activities Act, and as defined in the Prohibition of Mercer Activities Act. So those are basically the core functions of the NCCC, to deal with the regulation of controlled items, whether possession or use, but also to deal with the authorization of people under the Mercenary Activities Act. We're just saying the foundations on which the NCCC established should reflect what it does. And under it's a Roman figure 1. I think the Chairperson, we are just saying we are therefore including as you can see, it says conforms to international law and the regulation and the guiding principles and criteria contained in Section 15. The NCCC administers its work in terms of the NCCC Act, in terms of the criteria in Section 15. However, for Mercenary Activities Act, that criteria lies in Section 9. So we're saying the two criteria sections need to be recognized. That's what we are bringing on board here. And we'll proceed to Roman Figure 2. And again, there we are replacing the word conventional arms with the word possession of controlled items. And again, including the issue, the second function of the NCCC, which is the regulation of the rendering of activities under the...
I was actually far ahead.
Did you notice that?
No, it is right. Yeah. Because I had made a notation here, but I was asking the question in the wrong section. I made notes here. Thank you.
I think she will manage to catch up with Mr. Shah very soon. We'll catch up with Mr. Shah. on page 8, Chairperson, I think, again, on page 8B is the whole issue, again, of Mercenary Activities Act, replacement of conventional arms with the word control items and regulation and rendering of assistance in terms of the Mercenary Activities Act. That's what we're doing in B of that. And the same is the same thing that we're doing in C. As in B, we are doing the same thing in C, replacing the word conventional arms, replacing that with control items and rendering of certain assistance as provided for in that particular act. But the additional item, there, which is a D there, we are just saying over and above doing the NCCC, over and above just administering the NCCC Act, it's got a duty to fulfill the obligations that it has under the Mercenary Activities Act. And I think because that's the structure that is charged with the responsibility of administration. The next item shown on page 8 is amendment of Section 4 on the heading there says amendment of Section 4 of the Act.
And there we are just going to three Roman figure, well, 3-1-A. Again, there we are talking about, I think these are the functions of the committee in the original act. But there on the A, which is a small A there, it's 1A, it says, the committee, well, A says, therefore, establish processes and structures necessary for effective control of trade in and possession, and that is where we're starting to deal with possession. Yes, we are taking out the word conventional arms, replacing that with control items, but also adding the word possession to say that these are the two aspects that need to be dealt with. And further down, the second section, that is double A, small A and big A. Again, there we're saying establish processes and structures necessary for effective regulation of the rendering of certain assistance or services. Remember that the Mercenary Activities Act covers two aspects. It deals with assistance as well as services. So we're just bringing on board that particular aspect of services in there. It is required in terms of the provisions of the Mercenary Activities Act. And under B on page 8, we are just there again saying there should be different kinds of permits, but we're just saying under B, establish guidelines, structures, and process necessary for the scrutiny and assessment of an application for the issue of a permit under this Act, meaning the NCEC Act and the Mercenary Activities Act. So let's just say permits will be issued in terms of both, depending on what you are applying for. You may get a permit under the NCEC Act and a permit under the Mercenary Activities Act. It depends what you apply, the nature of your application was. We'll proceed to page 9, Chairperson. I think, Chairperson, the next section will be dealt with by my colleague, the next section, but I would indicate that. I just want to get in ready. On page 9, the C, Chairperson, we are dealing there again with the inclusion of the issue of the Mercenary Activities Act, which is a key aspect to this. We're just saying, in the liaison that government, that NCCC will do with government agencies on the administration of the NCCC Act, they must also do so in respect of the provisions of the Mercenary Activities Act. That's all that we're saying, that the agencies will assist the NCCC in administering both legislation. And proceeding, Chair, to page 9 still, but in the D, small d and a capital D. And that, again, caters for the NCCC, for the Mercenary Activities Act, in respect of saying, the NCCC therefore may grant or refuse an application for authorization as contemplated in the Act, because that's the duty that it has to do. So, but this is taken lock, stock, and barrel from the Mercenary Activities Act, just to ensure that you cross-pollinate the two legislation. And on F, Chairperson, it says they keep a register in the prescribed form of persons involved in trade in and possession of control items. But again, it's an issue of possession. We're saying people who've got who are trading as well as those who are possessing conventional arms, they must be duly registered in a prescribed manner under the NCEC Act. And under the next section, Chairperson, is a 2A. In the 2A, towards the end, again, we are replacing the word conventional arms with the word control items, but we're qualifying that, say, there's a trade in and possession of control items, which are two aspects. And that's all that we're doing on page 9, Chairperson. And on page 10, under the C, we are saying that, again, is a replacement of the word conventional arms and inclusion of control items as well as qualification with the word and possession. As you can see, the end position is double underlined. And we're doing the same in the next section, which is the D part of it. Again, we are replacing conventional arms with control items, and we're saying trade in and possession of control items. And we proceed to the C there, Chairperson, well, the C, or is the paragraph 4, I must say. That is a new section, and I think we have. I think this section never generated any discussion points, but it was what we call some attempts to legislate for future possible situations. And I think therefore the 4 and the 5
are actually dealing with that, say, in instances where future legislation can be established that deals with elements of conventional arms, if certain quantities are reached in respect of those, such a authorization must still be subject to the powers of the NCC. This is just a reflection of currently the police will do that in respect of the Firearms Control Act, and we're saying there will be situations in the future which are trying to anticipate that. And I think my colleague would proceed and deal with the amendment of Section 5.
Thank you very much. I will proceed with Clause 4. I think, Chair, we have already agreed that we replace conventional arms with control items wherever it occurs. And that's what we try to do in 3. I then move to page 11, dealing with the insertion of Section 7A, B, C. I think, Chair, the principle has already been established, that we will take out all the references to the establishment of the scrutiny committee, the composition of the scrutiny committee, and the functions of that committee. And that's what we achieve, we will try to achieve in page 11 up to page 13. We're just taking out all the references to the scrutiny committee. Those will all be deleted, Chair. Then in page 13, Chair, amendment of Section 9, Clause 7 there, Chair, again, we deal with the issue of conventional arms. We replace conventional arms with controlled items, but at the same time, we address the concern of Honorable Mr. Shah by inserting possession. Now we deal with trade and possession of conventional, of controlled items. So that's what we do in 7A. Again, in 6A, Chair, on the same page, we deal with the issue of inspectors, where we say the minister may, with the concurrence of the committee, designate any employee of the state as an inspector. Again, Chair, deals with the issue we have already dealt with, how we differentiate between what the minister must do and what the chairperson or the NCAC must do, administrative functions we give to the minister. Again, then we just empower the minister where there is such a need to designate certain employees of state to perform the function of an inspector. And in B, we also empower the inspectors to call upon the police to support them in the execution of their functions. Then we have a new section 7, paragraph 7, reading, in the exercise of powers vested in an inspector in terms of this, may call upon the police, which is exactly the function I've just highlighted. We double underline it because it is a matter that came out after the last discussion. That's why it's double underlined. I move, Chair, to page 14, what was then clause 8. Again, there, Chair, you will see there is reference to scrutiny. We take out the paragraph completely because it deals with the issue of scrutiny, which we have already settled, that no references should be made to scrutiny because it will not be recognized in law. What it basically then means, Chair, there will be no amendment to Section 11 of that Act. We will revert to the old position. That takes care of all of the amendment of Section 11, so the bill is getting shorter. Page 15, Chair, amendment of Section 12. Again, Chair, this is the issue we dealt with, and I think it was raised during the public hearing. The issue of what the functions of the Auditor General with regard to auditing the NCACC. We had erroneously inserted the word financial record. We're just broadening that function to cover the affairs of the committee. Then I move, Chair, to Clause 10, which is the substitution of Section 13 of the old Act, of the Principal Act. Again, we start with the heading, Chair. We remove references to conventional arms and provision of service. I think we agree that the collective term we will use now is control items to refer to the three categories. So we just replace those words with a control item. 13.1, Chair, again, we do the same thing. References to conventional arms are replaced with controlled item, and we insert the word possession because we deal with trade and possession. Then we delete again the references to A and B, or rendering of services referred to in Section 23. We just refer to Section 23, and I think Mr. Lima has already referred that. Section 23 deals with all the three categories. which is conventional arms, dual use goods, and services. So there is no need to refer to them separately there. In 13.2 chair, the issue we just discussed now of cross-referencing, which Dr. Korenov had raised, from 2 we refer, we try to do the cross-reference between all the other acts which deal with conventional arms and just try to manage the boundary there, that all those items that are controlled under those acts will not necessarily be included under the definition of possession in this one. And we deal with that in 2A, which relates to firearms. In 2B, we deal with the Explosives Act, which is managed under, by the police under that act. We deal with the Mine Health and Safety Act in page 17 on top. In C, we deal with the Weapons of Mass Destruction, which is dealt with in that act and administered by the Trade and Industry,
yes,
under the Non-Proliferation Committee. And in D, we continue to deal with the Electronic Communications Act. In E, we deal with Nuclear Energy Act. And I think what we need to change is what we agreed that we will update the memo on the objects to correctly reflect all the acts that we referred to here so that it reads well with the new act. Then I go chair in page 18 and deal with item G, which is a new insertion. Again, it's a matter that was raised during the public hearing that we need to create a specific exclusion or exemption with regard to issues of maintenance, repair, or upgrade of controlled items, that people who specifically deal with issues of repairs and all should not necessarily be subject to regulation under the Act for that purpose. So we create a very specific and targeted exemption of those areas. But we put certain targets with regard to for how long a person can keep that, and it must only be kept for a reasonable time in as far as necessary to effect the necessary repairs or upgrades. Then, Chair, I will move to page 19 on top. Amendment of Section 14.
Just a reasonable time. Have you guys come up ultimately to then say what is reasonable time? All the legal gurus. In terms of law, reasonable time constitutes what? Jeffers is an extremely difficult thing to deal with, but we have left it as reasonable time for the simple reason that I think circumstances will dictate your interpretation of reasonable time. Because if you're saying a person is doing a repair, if a person is supposed just to paint a military vehicle, paint it in green and brown, the question, one would therefore assume that painting of that should take a reasonable time. You would say, it, 5 days or so, you should be done with that. But a person can come and say, it's reasonable time, and he has been keeping these things for 2 years. So we are saying reasonable. But if a person is doing some serious work on the functionality of that thing, it may therefore not take a week, because it's going to take out certain parts, replace them, grind certain things, and all of it. So you may find that a longer time under those circumstances can be allowed. So it's a matter that will be dictated by circumstances and the facts of the matter at hand. Do you have that? What would you refer to? In the cases of precedence.
Chair, it's difficult. I think that the word reasonable time, or reasonable in general, is used by lawyers when they don't know what to say. Because it means you must make an assessment on a case-by-case basis. What will be reasonable?
That is why I wanted you to refer to the law of precedence. Then you can tell me from that point. No, accepted. It's a nice argument. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, then I proceed to page 19, amendment of section 14. Chair, Mr. Dunlap initially referred to the issue of permit. And I think when we dealt with the permit, we just said the permit is contemplated in section 14. And you will also see, Chair, that if we were to jump forward, we deal with under regulations that there will be prescribed the types of permits. So what we're basically saying, we're running away from defining permit, but we'll say we will prescribe what will be the type of permit that will be issued under the NCACC. So we just try to refine that, firstly by taking out the reference to conventional arms, replacing it with controlled items, and we insert the words that transferred or destroyed domestically,
And I think that was the issue that again was raised by AMSCO during the public hearings. So just to accommodate the concerns that were raised, those words were specifically mentioned there. Again, in B-Chair, conventional arms is replaced with control items, and the same wording of transferred or destroyed domestically is referred to. In B, again, at the end, the Chair, we insert the words rendered just to accommodate the issue of services, because you do not trade in services, you also render them, just to close that loop there, Chair. In C, Chair, we do the same thing. We replace conventional arms with controlled items in 5. I then proceed, Chair, to page 20 on top. We insert a new subsection. Any person who applies for a permit contemplated in this section must give an undertaking to the committee in the prescribed form and manner that the re-exportation of control item does not violate end-user requirements set by a foreign supplier. Again, Chair, the...
Chair, on this one.
You may.
5A. Any person who applies for a permit contemplated in this section must give an undertaking to the committee in the prescribed form and manner that the re-exportation of control item does not violate any... Okay. I suppose when you say prescribed form and manner, you have a procedure, so that's the undertaking the person is going to give. Can you unpack this for us? What are we actually talking about? Because we're saying that as long as that re-exportation of that control item doesn't violate end-user requirements set by any foreign supplier, am I right? Are we saying that something that we exported to another country now, they are re-exporting that? Is that what you're saying? That the original destination, country of destination, then re-exports but applies to us? What are we saying? Because if we say end-user requirements set by any foreign supplier, who is this foreign supplier that we are talking about? Can you just give us an example? So, because when you say, the moment we leave things to a foreign supplier, are we saying that we are referring to end user requirements set by other countries according to their standards, which might not necessarily meet our standards? So are we subjecting an item that went under certain rules, regulations, and principles as per our standards set by our house, now is at the behest and at the mercy of another country which has its own standard which we might not necessarily agree with? So can you just unpack this for me?
I think, Chairperson, I think this refers largely to a situation which is reverse of what Honorable Shah is saying. I think in the first instance, when South Africa is exporting to a foreign country, you are saying you want the country to make an undertaking that it will not resell and export that item without the consent of South Africa, because that is a South African product. But in this instance, another country, if we are buying an equipment from Britain will therefore say, South Africa must make an undertaking to Britain that says they will not re-export and whatever without the consent of England or of Britain. I think it's a practice. It's the other way around. That's why I say it's the reverse of that. And as such, therefore, when a South African company has this item, it's got an obligation to ensure that before it sends it over to another country, it must receive or seek the consent of England in this case, as an example. Exactly. So we are saying, therefore, as the Arms Control Authority, what is important, because you see the undertakings being made are made at two levels. They are made on the EUC. There's two signature blocks. There is a signature block by government to say, as an authority, we're signing, and also by the company, which is going to possess or to import this item. But all that we seek to do is that these companies must not come to us and actually mislead us and say, these items, we just seek to export them to country Y, finding that those things have got an obligation, that they must have a consent before. So the company in this must therefore say, this item does not have EUC obligations. We hereby declare that. so that when England is starting to have a case and say, why did South Africa export? We may therefore say, as the Arms Control Authority, we had taken undertakings, but then the company had therefore misled us. We can therefore proceed against them. So I think this is at the instance of items having come to South Africa, they are being re-exported, but not ours. It's a foreign item. It's just a practical situation, Chairperson. We want to, because you see, there's been instances of close to misleading that companies can do. I think we're just trying to close the possibility of a situation like that arising.
If Mr. Shah is happy,
yeah, fine. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. Then I proceed to amendment of Section 15 in page 20. Clause 12 again, Chair, we just replace the words conventional arms with controlled items in both D, E, and K. In page 21, Chair, substitution of Section 16. Accountability were conventional arms, that was the heading. Again, Chair, there we just replace the word conventional arms with controlled items. You will see that again in 16A, B, Roman 1, N2, Roman 1, I mean, and C, is the same principle. Conventional arms is replaced with controlled items. Arms is replaced with controlled items, which is a collective term for all three of them. So if I'm not over-summarizing, Chair, I think that's what happens in all those three. Then we can proceed to 22D. I mean, in D there as well, is the same principle. Arms is replaced with controlled items. Then I proceed to substitution of Section 17, Clause 14, which deals with the EUC. And I think, again, Chair, we've been over this. We've been through this over and over again. Again, the principle of replacing conventional arms is present here with controlled items, or arms with controlled items, and specific references to 23A and B. You will see, Chair, although in principle we are saying we will refer to them by means of Section 27.3, but where we want to distinguish between conventional arms and perhaps end services, we'll specifically refer to them in terms of their subparagraphs. And you will see there we deal with Section 27.3, A and B. We don't say anything about C. So whenever we want to refer to them jointly, we will say controlled items, but where we want to distinguish, we will use A or B or C, and that's what we're trying to do there. Then in B, again, check conventional items. Conventional arms is replaced with controlled items. So within C, then again, check in B, we just add the words there, as well as the use of site items, giving a description of controlled items and quantities involved, as well as the use of such items. Now it's part of the EUC. So in other words, you don't just declare the quantity, but as well as the use of those items as part of your EUC. Again, Chair, in C, we take out the word party, replace it by person. I think it's the whole issue of entity we had earlier on, entity, person, or juristic person. We use the word person to refer to all of those, as opposed to party. And the issue of verification certificate, we take out the word certificate and just talk of verification. I proceed, Chair, to page 23, 17.2, which is a new insertion. Whenever controlled items referred to in section 27.3c, again, Chair, we single out C because we have already in the previous section referred to A and B. Now we specifically want to limit to C. Whenever controlled items referred to in section 27.3c are exported, the committee may require a person authorized by the government of the country to which the controlled items are being exported to issue a certificate undertaking that the controlled item shall not be transferred or re-exported to any other person, used in developing or manufacturing weapons of mass destruction or for related purposes. Again, it's just the reverse of what Mr. Dada was explaining. Now, is South Africa requiring the certificate from the other country, as opposed to another country requiring the certificate from us? The committee may, on such terms and conditions as may be prescribed, exempt any exporter from compliance with subsection 1. And I think, again, Honorable Shah has raised it a number of times. He's concerned with regard to this. And I think Mr. Dada explained that the criteria or the conditions will have to be prescribed very clearly
so that there is no scope for abuse of that. Whenever control items and services are imported into the Republic, the competent authority of the South African government may issue an end-user certificate wherein an undertaking is given that the control items in question will not be transferred, resold, or re-exported. Again, it's the issue we just had a discussion that whenever there has to be a re-exportation, a company will have to give us an undertaking that there are no EUC obligations in respect of that item they seek to re-export. Chair, I then move to amendment of Section 19. Chair, here again, we deal with the issue of replacing conventional arms with controlled items. In page 24, amendment of Section 22. Again, Chair, the same principle, conventional items is replaced with controlled items. Substitution of Section 23 of Act 41 of 2002. Clause 17, Chair, we went back to the original heading of that. As per the insistence of Honorable Dr. Kwaranoff, the heading will go back to being disclosure and non-disclosure of information. But then, Chair, the whole issue, the debate we had with regard to reporting to the United Nations, to Parliament, and to Cabinet. Maybe I should just go through that. The committee must annually prepare a report and cause such report to be submitted to the Secretary General of the United Nations for the purposes of the United Nations Register of Conventional Arms, established in terms of United Nations Resolution 46/36L of 6 December 1991. Then there, Chair, we delete the word end, and we continue annually or from time to time prepare a report and cause such report to be submitted to any international body as may be required in terms of the Republic's international obligation. Inasmuch as we recognize the obligation to the UN, it may be that in future we may enter into other treaties which will require us to submit that kind of report. So we're just legislating for that. Then we go to C, Chair, on top of page 25, where we deal with the issue of report to Cabinet and Parliament on all transfers of controlled items concluded during the preceding quarter. Now again, we're back to quarterly reporting to both Cabinet and Parliament. And I think the principle has already been agreed to. In 2, Chair, a copy of the report referred to in subsection 1A, which is now your report to the United Nations, must be tabled in Parliament after the requirement contemplated in section 1 has been complied. In other words, Chair, the copy that goes to UN must also be tabled in Parliament. In 3, Chair, the committee must, at the end of the first quarter of each year, present to Parliament an annual report on all transfers of controlled items. Again, Chair, you will remember the whole debate we had with the limitation, because the Act as it stands only speaks of exports, but we're broadening that to say all transfers, whether it's export, imports, domestic transfers, and all of those, will be reflected in the annual report. The report contemplated in paragraph A must reflect the country, type, and description. Again, Chair, here we're trying to address the detail that we give to Parliament. We're just broadening to say country, type, and description of control items, just to cover the concerns that were raised with regard to the kind of information that we report on.
And the value.
Reflect the quantity of the control items involved, except if disclosure is prohibited in terms of a confidentiality clause in the contract of sale. Again, Chair, is the same issue, and we just cover the issue of confidentiality where there has to be such considerations, that those will be given consideration. Information concerning the technical specifications of control items may be omitted from a report contemplated in this section in order to protect military and commercial secrets. Again, Chair, the issue of confidentiality of certain types of information. But I think there were already concessions that were made that. I think what needs to be decided is how such information is being dealt with, if it involves such sensitivities. Again, Chair, in 5, we take out the references to scrutiny committee and the subcommittee, because in principle we have agreed that no reference will be made to that. No person may disclose any information concerning the business of the committee, except with the permission of a competent authority or as required in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, to a person who needs the information for performance of official functions or to execute the decisions of the committee. Again, it's just to impose some control measures of how we deal with the information
of the NCACC. Chair, then I move to page 26, substitution of section 24. Section 24 of the principal act is hereby amended. You will see, Chair, that again we were referring to trade in conventional arms in contravention of section 13. We just removed that reference because we had agreed that we were talking about all the three categories. So we simply refer to contravention of section 13, which then will cover the three categories, as opposed to specifically referring to conventional arms. Again, in B there, Chair, we take out B, a court convicting any person of an offense referred to in subsection 1A, B, or C may, in addition to any other penalty, which it may impose, order seizure of any goods or any article or any material or substance in respect of which the offense was committed. And we delete the last part, which specifically refers to the faculty for defense. Because the concern that we had with regard to that, but normally in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, all those items that were illegally possessed are normally declared forfeited to the state, and they go and get crushed somewhere. So we were concerned that there's a specific reference to the Secretary for Defense having to decide what must happen to those things. So we think it's better placed if it's left to the court to decide. I then move, Chair, to the issue of admin fines.
What's that? Currently, how does it go? Is it the state or the secretary?
Chair, I think that's what we currently, as the law stands, the secretary is supposed to determine what happens of those items. But I think from a practical point of view, Mr. Lala may explain, I don't know if there have been such items that were seized or forfeited to the state. I think from a practical experience, maybe he may make an
impact. Chair, there has never been. There's no record of anything of that nature having happened. But if it has happened, I think it would have presented a difficulty to deal with. I'm just saying in respect of the Secretary for Defense having to dispose of that, because people who commit violations in terms of this act, they may do so with items that not necessarily belong to Defense Department. Somebody might have bought a control item from country X and brought that into the country. And if you say that, therefore, if such an item is forfeited, it's SecDef who must decide how to dispose of it. The question is, what is the connection that exists between SecDef and that item? Because it could be a private item and all of it. That is why, therefore, we're saying, practically, it would have presented a difficulty. That's why, therefore, we're saying, we need to allow the court processes to deal with that as there is a clearly defined procedure of dealing with these items. Otherwise, I think it was in the previous, when they drafted that, there was an aid, they aid in doing so. Because practically, I think it belongs elsewhere. The reason why I'm asking is because the state, either they sell those things. Yet it's a situation where we want to destroy those things. I'm just posing that question. Will the state be able to do that, or is the state going to then solicit, that is, the assistance from the people who are able to dispose of such?
I think, gentlemen, it depends on the nature of the item. There are those which would deserve to be crushed. But some are generally sold off. You will find, like in the asset forfeiture section, I'm just saying, some of the items there, houses are not demolished, but they're sold, and cars are sold and all of that. I think it depends on the nature of the items, but I think they may not all of them be destroyed.
Even them is like, okay then, you may proceed.
Just a technicality, in the bill, section 18, after contravene section 13, there's the word and, which I see is omitted in this new version, you know, what we have before us. I just wondered, it doesn't seem if it makes a big difference, but I just wondered what the situation might be.
Thank you, Chair. Just a editorial typing error, basically, because we have the Gazette version, you know, after it's been proofread, and this one is the certified version, which we've just used to address the issues which or the amendments which are now presented by Mr. Dada to the committee, basically. But when we effect these changes, it will be incorporated on the bill that's before the committee. Okay, thank you.
Chair, I then proceed to admin fine, and I think we had a discussion this morning on this aspect. And I think, Chair, the principle here is to say, for specific kinds of violations, the committee may want to deal with these directly with an offending party, as opposed to referring the matter to the court, unless, of course, the member exercises his right to say, I would prefer to be dealt with in a certain way. The provision recognizes that right, but if a person makes a choice to be subjected to the NCACC, again, that will have to be done in line with the laws applicable to administrative justice, as Mr. Dada has explained. I don't know, Chair, if you would want me to go through that line by line.
Well, what does the member say? I have to satisfy members. Mr. Shah? I mean, we have gone through it, yeah. Unless you want to make some points of emphasis.
Well, Chair, I think then the rider is what we had already said earlier, that of course we will need to just apply our minds to the issues that were raised by Dr. Korenoff, if I'm not mistaken, this morning. Just that then we can come back to the committee if there are any improvements that perhaps may be done on this, or to address the concerns. So we will just request that opportunity at some stage to just apply our mind to the issues that were raised. So I think that's the only right I would make with regard to that.
I think, Chair, the fine, how is it accounted for, the fine? What account does that go into if you administer, you know, if you put an administrative fine, which account does that go into? Somebody has to pay a fine, for example. NCACC, DOD, what's that institution into which the account is held for fine?
Chair, if you look at page 28, sub 12, a fine payable in terms of inspection must be paid into the National Revenue Fund referred to inspection 2. Although, like the minister indicated, we would have loved to keep the money. But if it pleases the House Chair, I'll then move to page 29 without going line by line through the whole section. Right. In session of section 25A and 25B in Act 41 of
2009. Oh. Chair, again, here is the issue we debated this morning of exemptions. We provide for specific exemptions to be given to the South African Police and the Defence Force at the request of the Commissioner of the Police or the Chief of the FANDF. The chairperson of the committee plus one member may consider such exemptions and then grant the necessary exemption. Any request for an exemption under subsection 1 must be lodged with the Secretariat, accompanied by a comprehensive list of controlled items sought to be imported or exported, and the name of the country from which the controlled items are being imported to which they are exported. In other words, Chair, we try to build in some safeguards to say it will just not be a blanket exemption. There has to be a list against which at some stage we can be able to reconcile that all the items that were taken out are being returned at the end when whatever mission has been finalized. So there are kind of safeguards that are built into the system. Then, Chair, I proceed to the issue of industry internal compliance program, which is section 25B. The committee may determine guidelines for an industry internal compliance program. The industry internal compliance program contemplated in subsection 1 must, among others, provide for the principles of trade in and possession of controlled items, internal compliance procedures and methods to be followed, and standards to be maintained in the execution of certain activities relating to trade in and possession of control items. In order to encourage good practices, the minister may, with the concurrence,
with the committee prescribe a grading system in terms of grading, in terms of which person may be graded in accordance with their history of compliance and the industrial internal compliance program. Again, Chair, just to say, we, the NCACC will have the responsibility to prescribe certain standards to which the industry must aspire to. But we try and do it without really being prescriptive to them. They will be in a position to come up with their own program against which they will be measured. I then proceed, Chair, to Section 27, Clause 21, which deals with regulations and notices. Earlier on, Chair, we discussed the issue of permits. And in the old definition, there was an attempt to include permits in the definition of permit itself. But now, Chair, we provide that the minister may, with the concurrence of the committee, prescribe the types of permit in the regulations that may be issued. In other words, the whole issue of types of permits will be dealt with in the regulations, your manufacturing permits, your exporting permits, your importing permits, and all those kind of things. So there will be a comprehensive list as to what permits can be issued by the NCACC. Again, Chair, in page 31, D capital A, we deal with conditions and terms for domestic transfers of controlled items. Over and above the inclusion of domestic transfer and possession, Chair, we create a scope for the NCACC and the Minister at some stage to issue those conditions for the transfer of domestic items internally. And I think perhaps the issue of time frames and all those things can again be addressed in that. In D capital B, again, Chair, we deal with the issue of trading.
Chair, this term, conditions and terms, I think it's supposed to be terms and conditions, more appropriate. Though it carries the same, it should be terms and conditions, I think it should, not conditions and terms.
We're comfortable with that, Chair. We can change it around to terms and conditions. Well, I think that's how it's normally reflected, terms and conditions. So we will be happy with that.
Is it a question of a chicken and egg?
I then shall proceed to, on the same page, to sub 2, which has a change of numbering. But then again, at the bottom there, we delete the following words: any regulation which is likely to result in state expenditure must be made with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. And we insert, Chair, a new 3, the committee may by notice in the Gazette publish a list of control items to which this Act is applicable, including, again, we go through what in A is conventional arms, B is components, C is dual-use goods, and D is services. And I think we spoke about this a little bit earlier when Mr. Nadler was explaining the definition of control item. It refers to those three. Then in page 32, Chair, I proceed to amendment of the long title. And I think, again, Mr. Lamba has referred to the issue that in the long title initially we had already taken out the reference to scrutiny committee because we have accepted that there should be no specific reference or recognition in the law of that committee. And again, we take out the word conventional arms and replace it with controlled items in the long title. Then, Chair, we have the short title and the commencement date of the amendment bill. And I think that brings us to the end of the bill, Chair. Thank you very much.
I then thought you were then going to say, and the House is adjourned. members, I'll take that into Nitesha. Dr. Schoeman, to make some observations on progress, and also to reflect on the cooperation, the working together, and if there's anything to be appreciated, and if there's anything left to criticize the department on, can. But from my side as the chairperson, we don't want to hold you for long because we have to meet tomorrow. If we're agreeing on that, because we don't want to rush this. But I think up to this very moment, from the deliberations that we had earlier in time, it informs really what we would want to see the bill looking like, so that by tomorrow we're able to go through the bill clause by clause. We've been dealing with this for some time now, the to and froing, but in a way it did shape that is the kind of amendments that we want to come up with. But having said that, I will hear from you, Mr. Lala, after the members have spoken to you. If we can get that commitment, then we can agree that we deal with the bill tomorrow. We may as well sit the whole day tomorrow. We have permission to sit the whole day tomorrow, so that we can deal with it and be done. I'll start with Mr. Ntuli.
No, thanks, Chairperson. Yeah, maybe I'll start on page 31. I didn't hear that comment. Just to say, I know on the reference was made on that 4 in progress where any regulation which is likely to add or that 2 minutes of finance, if an elaboration could be made on that one. Yeah. I wonder if there was. Yeah. Then you said my comments, among others.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. I think the issue here is really the financial management principles that have been brought in by the PFNA. Now, the accounting officer of each department is responsible for the expenditure of its own budget. Now, you will find not only in this act, in a number of acts since the PFNA, the issue of consultation with Treasury or finance with regard to allocated budget, we tend to take it out, because now the responsibility lies to the account with the accounting officer, who then accounts to you with regard to that expenditure. So in view of the new financial management principle, it's not always necessary for an accounting officer of one department to consult with Treasury with regard to allocated and approved budget by Parliament, because he accounts directly to Parliament. Treasury only comes in when you have to get additional funds and all those kinds of things. So you will find that there is always that adjustment whenever it deals with issues of internal budget that has already been allocated and approved by Parliament. You don't need the approval of Treasury to do certain things within that framework. So I think it was in that context that the reference to consultation with the Minister, concurrence of the Minister of Finance, was taken out. Thank you, Chair.
No, it's fine, Chairperson. Although I take the explanation, I think to me I was comfortable with it, but I don't want to take you back. I'll leave it at that. One of the things I think, Chairperson, that we need to inform ourselves is what also the experience must have taught us by now, to say, you know, we're in an environment that is a bit sensitive. Now, I want to check firstly on vetting on the members. People will be dealing with this, because this deals with also interests of our interests as a country, but also other countries' interests. To say the individuals, now I'm talking the warm bodies that will be dealing with this committee, do they have to go through vetting? And if so, where is that being catered for? I'm taking here, for example, remember, what from the special defense package that ended up with one of the staffing person said no, it was not actually not even vetted, but it was handling that. That's one. But two, linked to that is the question of declaration of interest by all parties involved in this. You know, but my association, my being in the subcommittee or committee of anything that has to do with this NECC, to what extent do these warm bodies have to, you know, declare their interest? Because it's a fact that I might have my own interest in a country that is bidding elsewhere, but that I'm also sitting on this, and then I can't be assisting for my own, what you call, company to have its application, you know, processed, you know, fairly towards my side. So I'm asking two questions. They are separate: vetting, but declaration of interest on the other. Now, I'm going to the third one. The minister to serve, if I heard it well, in a subcommittee, you know, that deals with this also. There is a, what you call, chairperson, an inter-ministerial coordinating committee. But also drawing a lesson from what has transpired in this committee and other committees outside, for example, you would know to what extent would the reports to reach Parliament, be it quarterly, 6 months, or yearly, would be a struggle, have been a struggle. Now, how do we circumvent that this time? Because it has a bearing on governance, on how we do our oversight on this such an important structure. But then, also linked to that is, you know, politicians are quite busy indeed. Now, you say ministers serve, be it a subcommittee or on the committee itself. Our experience has been, and I also appeal at researchers, and I'm sure the department itself, you can go and do some homework on it. To what extent are the ministers actually meaningfully serving on such structures and giving it a political direction that is necessary? Because my fear is, Chairperson, this matter could be end up being run only by the bureaucrats. A minister coming at the time when it's suitable just to say, no, look, where am I signing? Just show me. I want to sign and run for the next appointment. And I'm sure you agree with that's not also to the best the interest of a good practice when it comes to governance now. Now, to what extent, you know, the politicians, the incumbent now, remember that you are even saying the way structure that it may not necessarily be the Minister of Defense who direct line will have an interest, will be serving here. Even the ones that are not directly, but they themselves paying particular attention to the matters of this committee, because you end up then having a committee that is there at the risk of repetition. But I think it's necessary that bureaucrats, and truly, I mean, they are there, they are being paid for, Chairperson. They are there, they come to work, and they come and do their work. But when things now go bad, then one of the things is because of the political incumbent was so much occupied, these other deployments, you know, that are so important to the country. But the fact of the matter, there has been a negligence of such a committee. Now, I'm saying, I don't know, Chairperson, where should that be catered for? Is it in the regulations? Is it in this act, or where?
I think that one, they'll be quite difficult. You're giving, we are starting all over again. We have discussed this for some time. And you're pushing them into a corner. This is a political issue that we're talking about, because the very reason, Mr. Lala, you know, we said the last time that we're here that it's been very diplomatic, because you cannot then begin to pinpoint to then say where the problem lies. As an official, he cannot go and say, you know, these guys are not wanting to. That is why they were pushing for the scrutiny committee. I mean, if you look, we understand the frustrations that they've been having. Now, it centers also around the question of our oversight.
Right. Not necessarily that they wanted to run it. It's because of the frustration that they experienced because the things were not happening. So now it resides upon us as politicians to then say, for the past 5 years, what has been happening with this particular committee? Because it was, in a way, causing them to take decisions. That's why the scrutiny committee, and that's why your auditor general then picked it up to then say, but there is this body that is beginning to do things. And they felt very strong that it must come up. So I'm then saying, this is our responsibility to do that kind of an oversight. Because they cannot cause them. I hear you when you say we have to put it in the regulations, but I don't think we can, because it was established for a specific reason and a specific role. It's a different animal to other animals that is constituted by ministers. So it then says, we as politicians, when we begin to engage on this, we then begin to, when we begin to debate the matter in the House, and if we have recommendations that we can come up with, it's us now that have to come up with them, because it's their function to see to it that it performs. Could we then begin to legislate when we've already legislated? They know it's their responsibility. I mean, they know that the Act says they have to do it. And if they then fail to perform, what do politicians do? Well, what do we do as Parliament under these circumstances? If a given department is not performing and functioning, what do we do? Because we have the right acts. And they are then called upon to perform a responsibility and achieve that responsibility. When do we do that kind of evaluation? Because as we continuously looking into the Act, as we're engaging on it, we then started to realize that there was indeed a problem and a challenge. Because one point that has been raised is that every member of cabinet runs a department. So he has an excuse, rightfully so, to then say, I have to perform my own responsibilities because I'm also. So how do we? Thus, the department, they came up very strong to then say, but why are you insisting that we have to have this quarterly report taped with Parliament, because we're finding this problem again of them not meeting? These are the things. Not that there was something very wrong with the Act. Not, absolutely not. They never met. They never submitted reports to Parliament when they are supposed to report. But the only area that I think even earlier in time is that I came up with is to then say, how do we then begin to assist the administration to see to it that these things do happen? But as much as we can beef up the administration, if there is no will from the drivers, then this is where we're going to be confronted with the problem. Because once again, we're going to be confronted with a situation where reports are never tabled. So it then comes back to us as politicians to then say, how do we then begin to come up with our oversight and what recommendations can we then make? I think we can further discuss that, Comrade Ntuli. Now, even if the department is not around to then say, how are we going to cause it to happen without even considering to have it in the regulations, because the Act tells. Chief.
No, Chairperson, I'm aware of the part of the discussion in this regard. What I had in mind, is that maybe, look, they've been on this thing. Maybe they could share some thoughts.
Yes.
Because we're now concluding a bill. Look, let's take how we manage our borders,
mm-hmm.
For example. Is the police, is home affairs, SARS and all that. It has to be an inter thing. You can't do it, but now it has got weaknesses there. We're just dealing with the other bill, the one of the DSO.
Yes.
It's very clear. One of the serious things that has led to this thing not to work as expected is, again, the interministerial thing. But now, what I'm saying is, perhaps it's because they must have had, that's what I'm saying, I'm not sure whether it must be in the regulations or it must be in the Act. Because, yes, you can make recommendations, but your recommendations, after you take off the podium, you are gone. The recommendations won't be attached to the Act, and the Act is passed. But what is it there that will constantly remind You know, when you say no, it becomes a mandatory document for you when you are serving in this committee. So where to pick up, say, I'm myself. Let's say even if you are running your own department as a member of cabinet, but you know that, okay, I've got four meetings for my own cabinet, but according to this other committee that I'm serving, for example, I must then allocate, because it says I'll have four meetings a year. I'm just citing as an example. Then in addition to my four meetings of my cabinet responsibility, I can add the other four from this one. So it becomes part of my program. But if it's then left for me to go and design it without any information, then that it may not be done. So I'm just thinking, how can we best arrest this situation? But perhaps, like you say, we can talk about it further in next time. But it just has been my clear concern on this. Thanks.
I think this is a concern that is an ongoing concern because it also relates to the performance of the various departments, as it were, and the ministers. So it comes back to us once again. I hear you when you raise this particular critical point and then say, how do we? Because we know with the officials, the MFMA and the local municipalities, the PFMA and the MFMA applies if they fail to perform. So it then takes us back to the man in charge, the president. Did you get what I'm saying? So I'm then saying it is important that we then begin to look into that because we know that the they have not been accounting. Well, what do we do with an entity if it's not accounting? What do we do with a department when it's not tabling its annual report? These are the things. It's Parliament again. It comes back to us because now it challenges the role of Parliament when we do our oversight over the departments and the entities thereof to then say if they are not complying with what is in the Act, what do we then do? That is why I was then saying to Raskuman, why don't we allow ourselves to engage on this? Because there is nothing untoward with what we are now presenting and coming up with at the end of the day. But what is critical and important is to then say, why were they not? If they had to convene, quite rightly so, do we put that into the regulations to then say, you have to have one day, you minister and that minister and that minister from the various departments that constitute the NCACC, to then say you have to have, and put that in a regulation that is going to apply to them all to then say on a given time. But it's in the Act. They have to meet. They have to sit down as part of their regulation. To then say, they have to sit down and then say, how often do we have to meet? Because nobody and no parliament prescribes to cabinet about their cabinet meetings to then say they have to meet on a given date. But it's themselves who regulate themselves to then say, if we want to do this, we have to do it. But as I'm saying then, I may as well argue. But why don't we then agree and totally ensure that we engage on this? I mean, this is our oversight. This is no back. Over to you, Peter. You are still on the floor. No. I was just talking to him. There's a question that he posed. I don't know whether there's anything that you intend to respond to that is from your side. I think we discussed that in the previous meetings again. Unfortunately, Sintulu was not around. Can we go back to that? Just a question of the vetting and all that. I think you responded to that. And the declaration of interest.
Chair, yes, you're correct. We did discuss the last time the issue of vetting, and I think our answer really was, in terms of our own legislation, which is the Defense Act, there are specific requirements on the issue of vetting that apply to the Department of Defense. And I think in the public service in general, there is minimum information for security standards, which applies as to what is required of me to access a top secret, a secret, or confidential document. So it prescribes to what documents can I have access depending on the security clearance that has been given to me. So I think public service-wide, there is a framework that deals with that issue. Now, of course, it is relevant because if you look at the NCACC, it is an interdepartmental thing. But I'm just saying there is already a framework that requires us, if you are at this level, you must have a security clearance of at least a secret. If you go to another level, at least you must have a security clearance of top secret. If you go, you must have a maximum of confidential. So the framework is there. And I will assume all the people who will get to work or interact with information from the NCACC, that is as much applicable to them as any other public servant. So there is that, unless, of course, one feels that there are specific requirements over and above what is already applicable to the public service that will need to be taken into consideration in respect of the NCACC. Then I think that if there is such a requirement, one could consider that. But I'm just saying, in terms of the public service, we have sufficient regulatory framework that deals with the issue of clearance. Chair, I'm not sure about the issue of conflict of interest. The issue of conflict of interest. But I suppose generally we deal with, in the committees, for instance, that one serves in, is either a procurement committee or whatever. There are normally declarations that all members make before each meeting begins. If you have a particular interest in a specific issue that has to be discussed, you declare that interest even before the meeting starts, then you may be excused from that particular meeting. But it is part of the code of conduct of the public service and the Public Service Act that no employee should put himself in a situation where he will have a conflict of interest. On an annual basis, in terms of the PSA, we are required to declare all the interest. There is specific documentation that we complete with regard to issues of declaration of interest. So I think there is a framework in which I am not sure about specifically the NCACC, what mechanism has it set in place. I think Mr. Zanda could speak to that. But in terms of practice, I think sufficient mechanism could be put in place for declarations before each meeting where everybody signs to cover the issue of conflict of interest. Thank you, Chair.
I think, Chair, on the practical side of things, in the meetings of the NCACC, what normally happens before the agenda is considered, I think there is the point that actually says declaration of conflict of interest. And it's the same thing that actually happens even in subcommittees or scrutiny committee, if we were to specifically talk about that. And people, therefore, would have to declare their interest. Well, whether they do so honestly or not, it's another thing. But there is a deliberate point that says declare your interest in these matters so that you can, therefore, be dealt with differently. But if you look at the Act, because it has just been brought to my attention, on the Principal Act, on clause number 25, it says that disclosure of interest, that is page 22, the Act, Principal Act, the NCAC Act. There is a section there that says that disclosure of interest, 25.1, it says, if any member of the committee, a subcommittee or a secretariat, or any inspector of the inspectorate has a direct or indirect pecuniary or other interest in any matter which could conflict with the proper performance of his or her duties in terms of this Act, he or she must disclose that interest as soon as practicable after the relevant facts came to his or her knowledge. So there is already a provision dealing with that. And I'm just saying that practically there's always a point that says let people declare their interest. And I think, therefore, if somebody does not declare, I think that, therefore, will constitute a violation of this particular section. So there is, indeed, a section that actually deals with that. But my colleague, Mr. Jigela, has dealt with the point of security clearance. But I think the point maybe that we may make visible is that politicians or ministers are not defined as public servants. They are defined as something else, as political office bearers or something like that. You may never find that the standard that is applicable to public service in terms of vetting may or may not be applicable. So maybe the same thing, maybe with politicians in parliament or MPs and all of that. So we will not be aware of that, but we can only speak about the public servants that are required and are regulated by that particular framework. But we're not particularly sure about politicians and office bearers.
Yeah, just to remind that even the appointments are made by the president for those ministers to serve. And the Act also prescribes, it's in the Act, and with that also that the Act also prescribes as to who must serve there. It's the one that does not have a direct interest. That is why it's not chaired by Comrade Terra. It's chaired by CBC the Act. He says, but he's not the chair, because he's seen as to be one of the persons that has an interest. So that is why Sonjika, the minister of and others, are the ones that the chair and the deputy is contained in the Act. And that's why I'm also bringing up the issue that they are also appointed by the president to serve in the committee. I've seen Mr. Fisher, I've seen Snombeko, then Mr. Shah and Mr. Schumann. I want to plead with you. I've requested your special responsibility and function, and Mr. Ntuli. The time is one.
Yeah. A repeat of our discussions on this issue of why we decided to scrap this scrutiny committee. Now, you know, in industry, you find there are two types of directors. You find the active directors and the sleeping directors. Now, you can be appointed in an industry to say you are a director of this firm, but you are not actively involved, but you are part of the direct list of directors. Now, the argument that we had was that originally on the Act, the ministers are not supposed to be sleeping directors, because as they are presently, they are sleeping directors, thus they are the sleeping members of that committee, because they give the work to the bureaucrats. It's the bureaucrats who are doing the work for them, instead of them being actively involved. Because originally, they are supposed to form the structure of that committee. And then the bureaucrats just to be additional to them. Now, our argument was that, no, it's not a question of that there's something wrong with the law, but something, they are not doing their duty. They are not actively involved, so that they are able to monitor the work that is being done effectively. I think that was the point.
I'm laughing, Mr. Ngiela. Because using terminology that the media would turn it around to the ministers are sleeping. And there was another one that was going around about. There's also a term that is always used about, snakes, when you kill a snake. Then there's another one, was saying, I've just decided to detox him. I don't know what that means out of my system. it was a partner to another partner to then say it was a relationship that went sour. So one said, no, I've decided to detox him. He's totally out of my system. This is number.
Chair, I was going to say before really taking the bill home, I think it will, like you have already suggested, that it will be proper for us to look at that part of the administerial committee as to how best to deal with it, because the law does outline it already, but the people have breached the law already, and how best are we going to be able to deal with that. Just want us to look at that thoroughly. Thank you.
Okay, no. it's a difficult one. But No, frankly speaking, I would say I know we know what is in the air of our country at the moment. And in us passing this bill, we are only saying it will only to be to the best interest of all of us and the generations to come to try and our best to make sure that we less reduce the weaknesses that are detectable in this whole legislative process. And yeah, let me say that, Chairperson, and commend the legal team, you know, from the department, that I know they spend endless time, you know, sleepless night to try and make sure that they were in line. You know, so I think from the bottom of my heart, and if I represent Shah well, I hear you, I see you smiling. I think I have got him. Therefore, I would like to thank everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm smiling because we are beginning to read on the same script nowadays, I see, and I'm very happy. I would like to thank Mr. Dadla on behalf of the committee. I wouldn't say my party because I'm part of this committee, so I speak for the committee proudly. So, because this committee is now beginning to work like one unit, unlike what it used to be previously, and we are taking note of your hard work. We commend you and your colleague for the diligence that you have shown. I know it has been often tough. Some of us have been grilling you and asking you questions sometimes that you can't even respond to. But yes, Chair, there was an issue which Honorable Dooley raised, which I also wanted to, the issue of conflict of interest and declaration of interest. As you are aware, I had issued a statement on the 7th of September concerning the Acting Secretary for Defense. And the fact that he is now acting, and he is also, it is alleged, I may put it in inverted commas, though perhaps I know more than that, director in Chancellor House Defense Dynamics, which is obviously linked with Chancellor House. and the fact that he is acting Sec Defense now, and the fact that he will be also having access to minutes, etc., etc. So it's going to, for me, at least for us, it's going to be problematic. I'm in the process of dealing with the matter with the Minister of Defense to ask him. And I like the man. He's a very nice person. Mr. Matumi is very good. But unfortunately, I see a conflict of interest generally, and I think it will also affect them. The Auditor General also referred to that. The second thing I wanted to say was, Chair, I think when we have the debate, we must also understand that you and I, we all know that they have problems in terms of capacity to actually fulfill their role. We must, somewhere in our recommendations, we must strongly raise the issue of resource, skills, and funding, and all of those matters very strongly to help them to do their work. I think we would have failed after having grilled them so much and the hard work that they've done. I think we need to actually help them to ensure that the skills and the capacity that they require is given to them. Finally, I'm glad that you have taken note of one of my concerns concerning the end-user certificate, the loophole that I see there. For me, it's still a loophole. And then I hope I'll take you to your word that this is going to be prescribed by legislation, internal regulations. It would have been nice if you could have made reference to that in the Act, but I can understand you can't put everything there. But if you could somewhere say that in terms of prescribed regulations, internal regulations, that the exemptions for the EOCs, that's what I'm referring to. So I'm glad that you have taken note of that. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson.
Just before I give it to Mrs. I think it is our responsibility, to look into the issue of regulations. I spoke to the Office of the Speaker very strongly about this. I think in our previous debates we spoke about this, to then say regulations must also come back to Parliament so that we can make some cross reference, whether they are talking directly to what the legislation says. Then saying it's one of the areas as parliamentarians that we have to look into. Dr. Scott.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. I can have the last word, so no one can come and contradict me afterwards. It's always a good position to be in. Chair, I don't want to rehash what has been said. I think when a bill comes before a committee, the first question one asks is why? Why was a bill necessary? And surely a bill is there after certain shortcomings within the existing act has been identified and to try and improve on that act. And if I look at the original bill that came before us and the thrust behind it, I think it also confirms the fact that what was said, that the NCACC wasn't performing the way it should have. And it was an attempt to within its operation, to change its operation so that there could be an enhanced performance. Now, the immediate question in my mind was, who is to blame for this evident lack of maximal performance or performance? I think we can point fingers, but some fingers are pointing back at this committee. Have we really succeeded in exercising our oversight authority the way we should have? So, in the end, when we look back at the amendments which we have agreed upon, the changes that we have agreed upon, the question is, three questions come to mind. Have we increased the original concept of the Act, which is namely one of transparency when dealing with controlled items or conventional arms, as it was described previously? Have we succeeded in improving the accountability of what this committee does to the Cabinet, to Parliament, to the people out there? And furthermore, have we succeeded in improving our oversight role of what this committee is doing? And I think in all three instances, my answer must be positive. I think that there will be more transparency. There will be more information which comes to Parliament, to this committee. We will exercise our oversight role more vigorously. I do think also if the NCACC, as it is constituted, is not performing, this committee will have the right to say, but why isn't it? Why isn't it sitting regularly? Why was there an attempt to delegate its authority to a committee of officials? Is it because of irregular attendance? Who is not attending? Why isn't it happening? Why aren't there quarterly reports? Haven't they been submitted to Cabinet, to Parliament? And I think once we have debated this bill and it's been approved and signed and sealed, this committee has an obligation to see that all these things are done in accordance with what will be the Act at that stage. Maybe some of us won't be there, but I hope there will be enough continuity within this committee so that that obligation which we have will be exercised. I do think that the the amendments, the changes that we've suggested from within this committee, the amendments which have served, are serving before us, is a great improvement. And I would really like to thank the officials that have come here and have subjected themselves to I think, some serious interrogation. Mr. Zaitla, Mr. Njikalela, and all those who assisted them. Thank you. We're not right at the end yet, but we're approaching the end, and hopefully tomorrow this time we would have sealed your hard work as well. Thank you very much. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dr. Scott. I was just thinking that if they don't report next time, you'll be calling them. I'm talking about the NCACC, so that Mr. Njigela and Mr. Lala not listen to what we're saying to them, because we should call them. The NCACC must come and say, why are they not performing their responsibilities like any other subcommittee or entity? It's the resource of a parliament to do that, not you guys. And I have to announce that we have our, before then, are we committing ourselves for tomorrow? I'm asking from Mr. Landlum that we meet and deal with them. I think, Chair, we're going to give it a best shot. We are going to look at these matters. To us, they are just two. It's just the definition of the word competent authority. Not definition, but amending the memo, the memo to reflect what we're saying in the bill. And also attempting to define the word special operation so that it eliminates the doubt. And also dealing with the issue of cross-referencing, ensure that the memo is amended is updated to actually reflect what is it that you're saying about cross-referencing. And obviously the point that Mr. Shah is stating now, just to see whether we can accommodate that issue about saying the exemptions will be dealt with in terms of our terms and conditions to be defined in the regulations, something along those lines. But I think we're going to give it a best shot, yeah? And in the morning tomorrow we can provide feedback.
10 o'clock at 475. That's where the meeting. And the members, immediately after tomorrow's meeting, the subcommittee that deals with AMSCO will be meeting. Mr. Shah, you got that.
Yes.
Marvelous. And we must be communicated also to that Novo of the IFP to be part thereof. Finger lunch is outside. Once again, we meet tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.